And the funniest thing about that is the first person I think of is JTG. And rightfully so, but I would actually want to take those classes of how to get paid for doing nothing and not getting noticed for 8 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
How to be a ninja, you know?
And by the way, Michael Cole referred to Grumpy Cat as Grumpy the Cat. Yeah, and you're Shitty the Announcer.
Worlds collide when the Sala Monster joins Anthony Missionary Thomas and Joey Numbers on a special Wrestling Soup.
Wrestling Soup.
Live this Tuesday, January 20th at 8 p.m. Eastern on WrestlingSoup.com.
I don't want my friendship with him to go down the drain like it has one time in the past with somebody else, namely Hulk Hogan. And I'm telling Hogan right now, too, sitting and watching the TV, if he wants to come over here and do it face-to-face right here on Raw, come on down, because I think Hogan's a prima donna, a backstabber, and he's a liar. And he thinks he's the Messiah walking around the face of the earth, and there's only one power, and that's up above, brother, and that's the way that it is.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
It's Sunday. You know what that means. It is episode 364 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for January 18, 2015. I am the Sala Monster, and you heard the big news at the top of the podcast. This Tuesday, January 20th, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I will be joining Missionary and Joey Numbers for the very first time on Wrestling Soup. This is like the meeting of the madness and the mania, only on a slightly lower scale. Show will air live on WrestlingSoup.com. It'll be on their feed. It is a collaboration that you guys have been asking for a while now, and we've been wanting to do it. It was just a matter of finding the right time, and then we did. And so we'll be talking Raw Reunion, which is going to be airing this Monday, the Royal Rumble, taking live calls, which should be fun, or a complete disaster. Either way, it should make for great radio, so Sala Monster on Wrestling Soup this Tuesday, January 20th at 8 p.m. Eastern. If you can't listen live, it will be archived, again, on their feed after the fact. So definitely check that out. That should be a lot of fun. And then for those of you who just can't get enough of my voice, I will be a guest on Heartbeat Radio with Bruce Hart this Thursday, January 22nd at 9 p.m. Eastern, streaming live on the Pro Wrestling Powerhouse Radio Network on Blog Talk Radio. Go to blogtalkradio.com/PWP Radio, and you should be able to find it there. All of these shows will be archived again after the fact, not just Soup, but this one as well. So if you can't listen live, I'll post links up on Twitter and Facebook. So it's going to be a busy week, and then we'll have our usual sound-off next weekend. We'll have a sound-off extra Royal Rumble wrap-up the day after the pay-per-view. So plenty of audio coming your way. And on that note, there are lots of different ways for you to support this podcast. Very easy. For example, you can use our Audible link, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. Sign up for your free audiobook. You get a 30-day trial of the service. Again, the audiobook you get to keep whether you stick with the trial or not. Tons of wrestler books up there. Brock Lesnar's book, Steve Austin's book. We have Hulk Hogan's book. Some of these books are narrated by the guys themselves. So use the URL audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. Tons of different titles to choose from. And spread the word. You get a free audiobook out of it. You got nothing to lose. And also, you can make a PayPal donation on thesalamonster.com. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname, as many of these people have gotten. Big thank you this week to those who have donated, including the Reflection of Perfection, Abraham Lara, Man Up, Manny Alcantara, Out of Control, Cody Thomas, Tori, All I Do Is Win, Johansson, The Fly Guy, J.W. Bridges, Ladies Man, Levi Daly, Guilty as Charged, Mark Court, and Devastation, David Uragas. Thank you very much for making a donation to the podcast. Still the most direct and easiest way to support this show, and you can do so. The little PayPal box is on the right-hand side on thesalamonster.com. And last but not least, you can buy a shirt in our store on ProWrestlingTees.com. We were one of the, if not the top seller for 2014 of all the podcast, YouTube shows that are represented with stores on that website. We were at the top of the list, and a big thank you to everybody who made that possible. But now I want 2015 to be even bigger. And we have a brand new shirt this week, hot off the presses, that is now in the store. We have two different versions of it. You can get it on a black shirt. You can get it on a sport gray t-shirt. It is the brand new Sound Off, It's Not Rocket Science, People shirt, which, for the record, I know Brock Lesnar is kind of known now for using that expression, but I was using that expression on this podcast long before Brock Lesnar ever did. And if Brock Lesnar has a problem with that, well, then there's really nothing I can do because he would kill me. So just, I wouldn't say anything about that. But anyway, two different versions of the shirt. You can pick them up, whatever color shirt you prefer. Brand new on our store, ProWrestlingTees.com/Solomonster. Sounds Off is the place to go. Again, they accept payment via credit card, PayPal, whatever works for you. I'm sure you can pay that way on the website. So please check it out and pick up a shirt in our store. Bunch of stories here to get to before we even touch on Raw or any of the shows this week, and there were a lot of them, but I want to start with this one. And this may be a bigger story locally, but there's a lot of history here, so I wanted to just give this a few minutes, and that is the fact that the Izod Center in East Rutherford, New Jersey, is shutting down. The news broke middle of the week. I got a text message with a link to a story on SEScoops.com. I was stunned when I saw it. This kind of came out of left field. It shouldn't have, because apparently the arena's been losing money for a while now, or it was due to lose more money this year in 2015 in the red. And that's for a number of different reasons, which we'll get to here in a second. But just to give a little bit of history on the building and why this is a big deal, first of all, SummerSlam this year was scheduled to take place at the Izod Center. You saw some of the earlier commercials for SummerSlam where it was coming back to the New York, New Jersey area. I was hoping it maybe would be at the Garden or it would be at the Barclay Center in Brooklyn, but they went with the Izod Center in New Jersey. And that was a done deal. And now they're going to have to find a new home for SummerSlam because they had a vote. It is now official. I believe it is shutting down. Is it in March? I want to say the end of March, but it's very soon, very shortly, that they will be shutting the building down. Most people called it the Meadowlands Arena. Then it became the Continental Airlines Arena when you know, they renamed it in the late 90s. And eventually it became the Izod Center. Named after the clothing brand. I've seen wrestling there in that building myself going back to the late 80s. And some of my fondest memories as a wrestling fan were in that building going to the shows that took place there. My very first Monday Night Raw, and I've talked about this on Sound Off before, my very first Monday Night Raw taping, it was live, but taping that I ever went to, was back in the Raw's War days. It was actually July 13, 1998. I still remember it. And I've told that story before. I won tickets from a local radio station to sit up in the luxury box. I got a personal meet and greet with a bunch of different wrestlers before the show. That was the night that I met Owen Hart. That was in that building. And then 2 years ago, the Raw, after WrestleMania 29, Dolph Ziggler cashing in Money in the Bank to win the World Heavyweight title. The place exploded. I mean, they exploded twice. First one is music hit to come out because everybody knew what was about to happen. And then when he actually beat Del Rio and won the belt, I don't know that I've been to a wrestling show where there's been that kind of explosion, like in the moment to something big that happened. And so that was also in that building. I mean, I've never heard a pop so loud in my life when that happened. But they lost the Nets team. They now play in Brooklyn. They lost the Devils. They were running in the red. So, you know, what the hell are you going to do? I guess there wasn't much use left for the building. Mike Johnson of PWInsider.com, he wrote about it as well. He had a great suggestion, which was, you know, this means that the house show, because they have a house show coming up at the Izod Center next Saturday, okay, 6 days from now, that's going to be the final WWE show ever in that building. And they've been running that building probably for a good 30 years now. They should do something special. What they should do is make it a special card and film it to air as a network special. I'd love to see it. I mean, I thought that was just a brilliant suggestion on his part because it's one of those buildings. It's not quite like Madison Square Garden, but it's got a ton of history with WWE, because WWE, you know, back in the day before they went national and they expanded, they were a Northeastern company. So they would run New York and they would run Jersey and Boston and they would go up and down the East Coast. So this is not just another wrestling building. I feel like there's a ton of history there. And just to add to what Mike said, just to add to his idea, I think what they can also do, they can pad the special by airing clips from some of the more famous matches that have taken place in that building, you know, at the Meadowlands over the years. And there have been plenty. So it's not just, oh, let's just air a house show on the network. You can turn it into something special. You know, there have been a ton of big matches that have happened there. You can air the full matches or air clips from them and really turn it into a 2 or 3 hour special thing that you can only see if you are a subscriber to the network. So just an idea. I have no idea if they're going to go in that direction or if they're going to do anything special at all for the show next weekend. I say, so the question now, I say, you know, SummerSlam has no home. They haven't made an announcement yet about where they're going to relocate. I say bring SummerSlam to the Tokyo Dome. Put fucking Jim Ross and Matt Stryker on commentary. But no, seriously. And I'm only half joking when I say that. You know what I'd like to see? They'll probably end up at Madison Square Garden or the Barclays Center. And if they do, look, I'll be there. I think we were probably planning on going to SummerSlam anyway, especially since I'm not going to Mania this year. But before they settled on the Izod Center, there were a lot of rumors, okay, they're coming to the New York, New Jersey area, so what building are they going to go to? And I saw a lot of rumors that maybe they were going to bring SummerSlam to Red Bull Arena, which is also in New Jersey. It's actually a stadium. The Red Bulls play soccer there. It's got a partial roof. It can fit 25,000 people. Although for wrestling, I mean, I would think for wrestling, they could probably get 30,000 in there if they wanted to. I don't think they've ever run a show there before. But for a show like SummerSlam, why not try to get a bigger crowd? I think 25,000 people would be doable for a New York, New Jersey SummerSlam. You know, especially if they have a big match on that card, a big main event that they're going to promote. I don't see why they can't get 25,000, 30,000 people in that building. So I'd love to see them kind of think outside the box here, and instead of just going back to the Garden, why not run a little stadium like Red Bull Stadium? I guess we'll find out. I would imagine they're going to have to make an announcement at some point this week. Or if not this week, then very soon. So we'll know soon enough. But anyway, SummerSlam is homeless for the time being. USA Network is bringing back Tough Enough. They made the announcement this week that Tough Enough is coming back. They plan to start filming after WrestleMania with wrestlers that are already under contract to WWE. But who have not yet appeared on television yet. So I'm just assuming by that it's going to be a bunch of NXT guys. You know, hey, Solomon Crowe, maybe he'll finally debut. Maybe they'll put him on Tough Enough. They said the show is going to have a completely new format with live elements that will truly make this event television. I always worry when I hear bullshit like this. That's like television executive bullshit speak. That doesn't mean anything to me. And it just makes me worry about what kind of ridiculous concept they're coming up with for the show. I mean, look, if it involves fan voting and stuff, that's fine. But, you know, to me, I read something like that, and it's just television, you know, executive nonsense. That doesn't really tell me anything about what they have planned. I hope they bring back Steve Austin to host. I thought he did a bang-up job last time. He was one of the most entertaining parts of that show. And I like Tough Enough, but he was really one of the most entertaining parts of it. They've said nothing. I don't think Austin has said anything, so we really don't know any more than that, other than I guess it'll be on television later this year. The first season of Tough Enough, by the way, on that note, from the MTV days, not the last USA Network version they did, but the original Tough Enough, has been added to the WWE Network, which the network launched early in Ireland and the UK. It was not supposed to launch there until tomorrow, January 19th, and you guys were sending me messages on Tuesday that, hey, I can sign up for the network and it's working fine. So they took the geo block off, I guess, and you can sign up right now if you are in that part of the world for the network. So get on that. Everybody that I've heard from seems to be very happy with it. They've been starred for the network for so long, and they kind of jerked them around so many times. That now that they finally have it, it's nice that people seem to be enjoying it. So if you never saw the original Tough Enough, or if it's been, I mean, I guess it aired in like 2000 or 2001. It's been that long since I've seen that first season. I haven't gone back and watched it yet, but I'm planning on doing so. I'm very curious to go back, and I've got fond memories of Taz bullying poor Daryl. I think on the reunion special they did, which I don't think is on the network, but they did a reunion special after the season ended. And I remember Taz just would not let up on this poor bastard, this Daryl guy, who was this big, you know, kind of out of shape guy that, if I remember, had a bit of an attitude. And Taz just kept railing on, even on the reunion special, they're all sitting around, and Taz is like, you're a bitch, you'll always be a bitch, and when they put you in a pine box 6 feet under, you'll still be a bitch. And then Daryl, like, walked out. It's too bad that's not on the network. But anyway, Triple H's infamous speech where he buried Bill Goldberg and lectured all the students. You know, that was the season that had Maven and Nydia and Josh Matthews and Chris Nowinski. So I'm looking forward to going back and watching. Actually, Maven is a bouncer now. He's a bouncer at a bar in New York called Midtown 1015, which is not far from where I work, actually. And I always keep telling myself, I want to go by there and just see if it's really him. I've had a bunch of people tell me that's it's him. You know, that's the bar he bounces at. Apparently, he doesn't like talking about WWE. Or maybe people just caught him on a bad day. I don't know. But that's what he's up to these days. Stephanie McMahon. I'm going to talk about her. And I know, you know, she made a bunch of comments in a podcast interview that she did about the percentage of women that make up the WWE audience. And I can sit here and kind of laugh at that. I mean, who's to say? Maybe the statistics they have are valid. I don't know who these women are that are watching WWE, unless they're watching, you know, with their boyfriends and they feel like they have no choice. I know a few people who have gotten into WWE, female fans that got into it because of Total Divas, but not many. I mean, I can't imagine that Total Divas has really brought in a ton of new fans. I know it's brought in some, but it has not brought in a ton of new fans. And so I don't know where they get their numbers from. That's not even what I wanted to talk about. The bigger news, I think, that came out of the Stephanie McMahon interview was the reason why there is no more Elimination Chamber pay-per-view in February. And if you thought that WWE did away with the Elimination Chamber because they realized it was kind of pointless with there now being only one championship, and so they used their common sense to determine that, okay, it probably doesn't make any sense, really, to have this big gimmick show between the Rumble and WrestleMania. Or maybe they just thought, you know what, there's too many gimmick pay-per-views as it is. Well, think again. In fact, the reason there is no more Elimination Chamber pay-per-view is because as the arenas change, there's a lot of newer buildings now, they cannot support holding up the structure. They claim the chamber structure weighs 10 tons. I find that hard to believe. Maybe it does. I'm sure it's very heavy. It weighs a lot, let's put it that way. And I guess a lot of these buildings, they can't support the structure. They can't hold it up. So they've done away with the pay-per-view. Now, I was under the impression they just moved it. They moved it to June. But then I think the pay-per-view schedule came out, and it's no longer listed. So I guess they will only do Elimination Chamber matches when they run certain older buildings now, I guess. I don't really care. I didn't hate the Elimination Chamber concept. I always thought it was a poor man's War Games because they were so reluctant to use the War Games concept, which I think would have been more interesting, having two rings side by side. But again, you know my thoughts on these gimmick shows, and the Chamber one is the one that maybe bothered me the least. I think there's a lot more damage done by having a Hell in a Cell show every year and a TLC show. Money in the Bank less so, although part of me does wish they would just kind of merge that back into WrestleMania. To me, Hell in a Cell and TLC are the two biggest offenders. They need to get rid of those shows yesterday. The Chamber didn't bother me too much, but again, it's like, oh, it's time for the Elimination Chamber, but what if you don't really have a need anymore for the Elimination Chamber? Why not just save it like you would save a War Games match to blow off a big feud between different people? I think that's the way to do it, and I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing. I think it's a great thing that we don't have a Chamber pay-per-view now every February. If it were up to me, I wouldn't have any pay-per-view in February. I don't think you need one. If you want to have a little special event on the network, then by all means, go ahead and do it. Like the old Saturday Night Main Event specials. But do you really need to have a pay-per-view every February? I know they've done this for, it's been going on now since the In Your House days. This is nothing new. I just don't see the point. I really just don't see the point. It's not as though people honestly believe the direction of WrestleMania is going to dramatically change based on something that happens at the February pay-per-view. Very rarely does that happen. You know, and now it's this show called Fastlane, and I see the rumored main event that's listed in the local market is John Cena and Roman Reigns against Seth Rollins and The Big Show. That's my thoughts on that. Never before have I wanted a show to live up to the fine print on the bottom that says card subject to change than I do with that pay-per-view. One last note here. I have to mention this. Daniel Bryan, who is back, by the way, he wrestled on SmackDown this week. He did an interview with AlternativeNation.net. And I hate to beat a dead horse, but the fucking thing's already dead, so I'm sure it won't mind. This was the first acknowledgement publicly that I have seen by anybody, and the first acknowledgement I've seen by Bryan himself, that the internet reports that he was scheduled to wrestle Sheamus at last year's WrestleMania was true. He said that, as far as he knew, he was supposed to wrestle Sheamus, not be anywhere near the main event of the show. This is what he said. He said, "So I was never supposed to be in that match. The crowd reactions are what forced me to even be given that opportunity. I was surprised that the crowd was so vocal because it was clear when Batista came back that he was supposed to be the returning hero. He was going to main event WrestleMania against Randy Orton, and that was the big plan, but the fans changed that plan. I wasn't supposed to be anywhere near the top of the card. I think I was scheduled to wrestle Sheamus and probably be fifth or sixth match from the top and maybe get a 10-minute match if we were lucky, but because of fan support, all of a sudden now I'm doing two matches and I'm in the main event of WrestleMania." So that's big. I didn't really see, you know, that reported in too many places, but to me that's huge because that's the first real acknowledgement that these internet reports were true. And you'll always have people, "Oh, the dirt sheets, you can't listen to the dirt sheets." I always laugh at that because most of the information that comes from the more reliable sites and sources, whether it's The Observer, The Torch, PW Insider, like, to me, those are the three right there that I look at and I say, okay, these are the more believable, trustworthy internet sources that are out there. And you know, Jason Powell of ProWrestling.net, you know, he's broken some stories too. But you'll have these people who absolutely, who just cannot believe anything that is reported on any of these websites, ever. If it came from a so-called dirt sheet, well, it's just a rumor, you can't buy into it. And then, invariably, when, you know, 75% of the time or 80% of the time the story comes true, and we find out that it was legit, you never hear from those people. You never hear those people go, "Oh, wow, well, you know, Powell was right, or Keller was right, or Meltzer was right." Nope, they just keep their mouth shut. And the next time there's a big story that sounds like it might actually have some legitimacy to it, the same people will say the same garbage. So you got to call a spade. I mean, when those guys are wrong, they're wrong. But when they're right, you got to say that they're right. And I heard that report from so many of those guys that I knew. I knew where there's smoke, there's fire. That has to be what's going on here. And you can just watch the television show and you can tell the direction that they were kind of going in. And it was a combination of the fans, and it was a combination of CM Punk walking out. And that's the only reason Bryan got that Mania main event. I'm happy he did. I'm very happy that they did the right thing. But you have to acknowledge that they had their hand forced. And I've had this debate with other people before. And again, these people, they don't get it. You know, they don't understand. Why do you keep bringing it up? They did the match, so what are you complaining about? It's not a matter of complaining about anything. It's more an indictment, I think, on the decision-making process sometimes that happens in this company that worries me. Because when something seems so obvious going forward, when it seems so obvious now, right, that Roman Reigns is not ready. I think Roman Reigns is going to be the guy, but Roman Reigns probably would benefit from having another year before you put the title on him. I think it would probably work to his advantage. Whether you turn him heel or you don't, just give him some more time. You know, so the fans don't resent him. They feel like, "Oh, you're pushing him too quickly." Meanwhile, you got this other guy, Daniel Bryan. "Oh, by the way, hi, I'm over here." He just came back. He's got a built-in story where he never was beaten for the championship. He had the title taken away from him because of an injury. Now he's back. He's on this road to redemption. He's in the Rumble match. The people are still behind him. They haven't cooled. You look at that reaction he got on Monday night. They're chanting his name. They're chanting yes. They're going crazy for the guy. People want to see Daniel Bryan kind of get back up, I think, on top there because they feel he was, not that he was cheated, I guess, but, you know, he got hurt. It was a shame he never really had a chance to have that run. I would say that if Daniel Bryan came back and the people were kind of like, okay, great, Daniel Bryan's back, then it's like, all right, the guy's cooled off. Maybe we should do something else with him. He hasn't cooled off. You got him back just in time for WrestleMania season. It seems obvious what direction you should go in here. Are they going to go in that direction? I don't know. We'll find out at the Royal Rumble, I guess. But whether it's that or something else, or it just, to me, you have to you have to understand that when something like this happens, it's perfectly okay to look at it and question the sanity of the people who make these decisions. You can't just brush it under the rug. Well, who cares? They gave you Daniel Bryan in the main event anyway. What are you complaining about? What are you talking about? There's a bigger issue here. The bigger issue is the decision-making process of the people involved. How do they not see a year ago what we all saw? We're not the ones who get paid to write the fucking show. How is it that they didn't see what we saw? How is it that they could be so stubborn and so set in their ways? And maybe it's just one guy. Maybe at the end of the day, there were people there who saw everything that we saw, but it was one guy. And you know who that guy is who said, this is the plan, and this is what we're going to go with. Damn it. And then circumstances turned out to be what they were, and I think we got a much better WrestleMania for it. I shudder to think what the reaction to that main event of Batista versus Randy Orton would have been had they kept that main event as is. Had they never turned Batista heel, and had they just kept that match as a one-on-one match. Especially coming off Undertaker losing the streak. I mean, I was in the building for that show, and for the Divas match, they were dead. It was like a funeral in that building. At least the main event having a happy ending and everything kind of brought people back into it. Can you imagine coming off the Undertaker streak ending the way it did? The state of shock that everybody was in, and then you give them a Batista versus Randy Orton main event? What a fucking disaster that would have been. So, I just wanted to mention that because I think it kind of makes you shake your head now that you heard it from the horse's mouth. It's like, wow, that really did happen, and these people just don't have a fucking clue sometimes. And they got very lucky. They got very lucky because the fans were that passionate about seeing this other guy in the main event, and Punk walked out, and it just they got handed. They got handed this scenario with a bow on it. It was a great underdog story, and I think it made for the best WrestleMania probably in over a decade, in my opinion. Let us hope they have a much better plan on the agenda for Mania here in January than they did a year ago in January. So I think those are all the notes I wanted to get to. So we should probably get into Raw. Raw was from New Orleans, Louisiana, the site of WrestleMania last year, in fact. And the big news coming out of the show was the Macho Man, Randy Savage, finally getting his long-anticipated WWE Hall of Fame induction this year. Not very surprising. I think we all expected it. Most people probably expected it when the DVD came out. And then after that Austin podcast where he put Vince on the spot, you know, people were asking me, who do you think is most responsible for this? I think Steve Austin, maybe more than anybody, is responsible for this happening when it did. I mean, maybe it was going to happen anyway. Again, the DVD had come out. They were back on good terms with Lanny Poffo, and they interviewed him for it. But it was Austin putting him on the spot in that podcast that aired on the network, and Vince was just like, of course, yes, he's going in. And then Austin just stared at him. He made Vince uncomfortable. He's staring a hole at this guy, and Vince is like, what? And Austin's like, so he's going in. It was almost like Austin's way of saying, like, I want you to commit to the fact that this guy is going in now. He's going in this year. And Vince wouldn't go that far, but I think Steve Austin deserves a shit ton of credit because I think he helped this process along maybe more than anybody by putting him on the spot like that. The video they aired on Monday night was probably the best part of the entire show. I didn't think the show was terrible, but I thought the Savage video was just so well done. And you know, they didn't give it like a sad, somber thing. They gave it this upbeat, you know, piece of music, and it just, I don't know, when it was over, I had a huge smile on my face, and it really illustrates when you just watch that video, like, there will never, ever be, I don't care how long wrestling exists, it could exist for another 1,000 years, there will never be another Randy Savage. There just won't be, and there will be people who imitate him, there will be people who borrow from him, God knows everybody else does. I mean, Jay Lethal made a career out of it for a couple of years there. Everybody else, the Randy Savage elbow, and got people trying to cut promos like Randy Savage, which nobody can do. Nobody can cut a promo the way Randy Savage did. And let's be honest here, as great as Randy Savage was, one of the things that helped Randy Savage and a lot of guys back in the 80s in those promos was coke. They were all coked up. Those were coke-fueled promos. You can't do coke now, unless you're John Jones. So anyway, this was great. I'm happy. Better late than never. They're giving him his just due as far as just, you know, putting his name out there and just seeing him have a video dedicated to himself on Raw. I'm going to get into a whole thing about the Hall of Fame later on. Somebody sent me a mailbag question about it. I'd rather save it for then and get into this whole argument of whether the Hall of Fame really means anything or not. Because I've had a lot of people ask me that question, but I want to answer this guy directly. So I'm going to save that for later. Hulk Hogan, of course, is doing the induction. You know what? I'm going to wait until later. I'll get into that a little bit more later as well on my thoughts on Hulk Hogan being the one to do the induction. I know why they did it. I know why it's happening. But I will save that for later. I will say this, though. My Hall of Fame wish, I would love for Black Machismo, Jay Lethal, dressed up as Black Machismo, to accept on behalf of Randy Savage. And he's out there on stage doing the Mega Powers handshake with Hulk Hogan. Either that or a macho hologram. That's an idea that I've batted around for a while, ever since I saw Tupac at, Coachella a few years ago? Okay, because as far as I'm concerned, if it's good enough for Bray Wyatt, and it's good enough for Tupac, then it's good enough for the Macho Man. Maybe that's why they've waited so long. They've been working on the technology. We're going to get a macho hologram at the Hall of Fame. Let's talk about Raw. The best praise I could give the announcing on the show on Monday was that it was less bad than it has been in the past. It was less bad than it was with Lawler at the desk. I thought Booker was fine on this show, but you've still got JBL out there, so that's kind of a problem. So John Cena opens the show, as he has so many times before. Last we saw of him, he was a sad little boy, a confused little boy, who had just cost three of his friends their jobs. So what is his disposition on the show when he comes out? I mean, do I even have to ask that question? Of course, he's smiling. He's smiling, he's interacting with the fans. Because fuck those men. I've still got my championship match at the Royal Rumble. I shall win the title in their honor. And then he threatens, John Cena does, that after he wins the championship at the Royal Rumble, he is going to sit at home on his couch and hold the title hostage. This is his great plan. He's going to win the title, go home to West Newberry, wherever his mansion is. I guess now he lives in Florida. And he's going to sit there and hold the championship hostage at home. That is his great plan. Do the people who write this show even watch the fucking thing? I'm being totally serious right now. Do the people who script these shows out actually pay attention to what happens on television week to week? We have a champion right now who does just that. We see him maybe once every 12 weeks or so, maybe, on average. No champion on the show, no title defenses for months on end, and that is John Cena's great threat to the authority. So sure enough, Triple H comes out with Stephanie and the rest of the group, and he's laughing at John Cena for being stupid, which of course he is, for saying something so completely asinine. Triple H, the great guy that he is, he is sympathetic to John Cena's plight. He offers him a chance to win back his friend's jobs. All he has to do is beat Seth Rollins in a lumberjack match. That's it. Out come all the lumberjacks. They're all heels. They beat up John Cena whenever he gets thrown out of the ring. They hold back whenever Rollins gets tossed out. I thought the two of them had a good match. You know, it was good. I just feel like we've seen the same routine with them a million times already. There was nothing extraordinary about this match. It was every John Cena, Seth Rollins match they've had on TV, except this time there were people surrounding the ring. Rollins, you don't need me to tell you this, Rollins is quite great inside the ring, but we already know that. Big Show gave Cena the knockout punch in the middle of all this mayhem, and Rollins got the pin. So John Cena, in fact, did not overcome the odds on this show. I had to pinch myself. I didn't know what show I was watching. Backstage, Stephanie McMahon told the Usos to let Naomi know that she would be in a match on this show later on with one arm tied behind her back. And then she told Dean Ambrose that he would have to undergo a psychiatric evaluation or risk being taken out of the Royal Rumble match if he could not pass. You know what I'd like to see? I'd like to see everybody involved in the week-to-week creative process of this show be forced to undergo a psychiatric evaluation to deem them fit to write this show or be removed from their position. That's what I would like to see. Ambrose met with the doctor, who put a clock in front of Ambrose, who just stared intensely at the clock like he was in some kind of trance. They didn't say this, but the reason he had that look on his face is because he couldn't believe there was still 2.5 hours left in the show. So we had the New Day, Kofi Kingston and Xavier Woods beating Kid Cesaro, Tyson Kidd and Cesaro, pinning Tyson Kidd with a double foot stomp. This made me sad. You know, they've already given up on doing anything meaningful with the New Day. They're just kind of there to fill the mid-card. But Tyson Kidd and Cesaro are a new team. They've got some chemistry, and you beat them. I don't understand it. At this point, they told us that Randy Savage was expected to be announced for the Hall of Fame later tonight. He was expected to be inducted. I mean, I know this was a stunt for ratings, but doesn't mean it sounded any less stupid. That'd be like me saying, you know, next Sunday, there is expected to be a brand new sound-off. And it might even drop in the afternoon. Don't hold me to that, but it's expected. Big Show came out. Oh, boy. Big Show came out to cut a rambling promo insulting the fans. Finally, after 5 or 6 minutes, he said, which brings me to Roman Reigns. It took you 5 minutes to say that. You couldn't just say that right off the bat. He did mention, though, in his whole spiel that he had won the WCW Championship in his very first match against Hulk Hogan, which is true. What he did not mention is that he won the title by DQ, which is WWE's favorite finish now. I don't know why they wouldn't mention that. And he was stripped of it a week later. And he also didn't mention that he and a giant mummy sexually assaulted Hulk Hogan with a bear hug. I would leave that part out, too, so I can't blame him for that. Roman Reigns made his way through the crowd and into the ring. The Nicolas Cage of WWE. Nicolas Cage just gets the absolute worst scripts in the world. Roman Reigns doesn't pick them himself, but he also gets the worst scripts, as was evidenced here. He told Big Show a story about a little boy called Roman and his beanstalk and finding gold coins. And dear God, it was everything Roman Reigns should not be saying. That's the only thing I could think of as I listened to him. Because he came out, and the people were into him, and I think he made a comment first, and then he launched into his story. When he hit the beanstalk, he lost the crowd. And by the end of the promo, there were people booing. That's how you know you have lost the crowd. When they boo you at the end of your babyface promo. And that's what they did to this poor guy. You know, of all the stupid things that WCW did in its existence, they were at least smart enough not to have Bill Goldberg go out there telling stories about magical unicorns. They are trying to turn Roman Reigns into John Cena, and that is the absolute worst thing they could possibly do, is to turn him into the next John Cena. Just let him be himself. I see Reigns, you know, someone posted on our Facebook group. He is front and center in the new WrestleMania magazine that they just released. They have a whole bunch of guys in the cover. It's not John Cena in the middle, it's Roman Reigns. So they're already phasing him in as the next big guy, as the next top guy. They got big plans for him. If you want him to be John Cena, then just go with John Cena. Just go with John Cena. Every top star before John Cena was different in some way. They each had their own unique personality. Seriously, if that's what you want, if you want John Cena, then fucking go with John Cena. God knows you've done it for 10 years now. What's another 5? Just go with him. But don't turn this guy into Cena 2.0. This guy could be somebody. I know not everybody is a Roman Reigns fan. They haven't come around yet. They may never come around. That's why I said earlier, I think he would really benefit by having maybe another year before you thrust him into that WrestleMania main event. But there's real potential here, and I feel like it's not even that they're trying to intentionally sabotage this guy. They really honestly think that this is going to help get him over as, like, the next big thing because it worked for John Cena. What worked for John Cena will not work for everybody else. It would not work for Dean Ambrose. It would not work for Roman Reigns. It would not work for Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan, even, is a completely different personality from John Cena in every way, in every conceivable way, from his physical appearance, to his personal interest, to his wrestling style, to his promo style, to everything. And guess what? The people love the guy. They chant his name. I don't want to see an army of Cena drones. That will not work. That, I think, is maybe the most egregious offense to all of this. As crappy as these promos are, that supposedly Vince McMahon himself is the one behind, I can believe that. That's a rumor I can believe. But to me, the biggest offense is the fact that they're trying to turn him into something he's not. And that's going to fail. It's just not going to work. And what they'll have to end up doing at some point, unless it's the plan, and we just haven't seen it happen yet, but what's going to end up happening here is they're going to have to turn him heel. It's going to be like The Rock in 1997 all over again. This is not working. We have no other choice. Let's turn him heel. And maybe in the long term, that will be to his benefit. But you're handicapping this guy right out of the gate. You don't have to be doing that. So Reigns stayed out there after his amazing promo for a match with Luke Harper. It was a good little match. You know, two big guys just beating the hell out of each other in the ring. Roman got the win with the spear. Big Show KO'd Reigns afterwards with the punch. So they're going to keep this feud going into the Royal Rumble. The storyline here is that Big Show says, I'm going to win the Royal Rumble because nobody can lift me up over the top rope. Don't even get me started on that whole thing. We've seen this guy. This guy's been in WWE for how long now? 38 years? How many fucking times have we seen Big Show body slammed by a nobody in the ring, let alone eliminated from the Royal Rumble? And I know there was a Rumble in 2004 that we can't really talk about. I remember him being dumped out of the ring in that Rumble as well. But that goes back to something I said on the show months ago about how I think it was Mark Henry and the Big Show against the Wyatt family in a tag team match. And in the middle of the match, Eric Rowan, I guess they were trying to get over how strong Eric Rowan is. In the middle of the match, Eric Rowan picks up the Big Show for a body slam, gets him all the way up, and he slams him. And I just remember thinking to myself, and I even said it on the podcast at that time, what a waste. What a waste. It was a big deal at WrestleMania last year when Cesaro lifted this guy up in the air and dumped him out of the... Oh, that's another one, by the way. Less than a year ago, we saw Cesaro lift him up and dump him out of the ring. We're not supposed to remember that. We're supposed to completely forget that guy ever got pushed in the first place. But, like, that was a big deal. That was an incredible feat of strength, and it meant something because it happened at WrestleMania, and it resulted in a big win in a battle royal for somebody. Whereas on Raw, in a throwaway tag team match that nobody except maybe myself will ever remember, fucking Eric Rowan, who wasn't getting a push like he is now, he was part of a tag team, and you waste a body slam spot on him. You know, stuff like that needs to be built up so it's special. So when I hear Big Show doing a promo, nobody can pick me up and nobody can dump me over the top rope, why would we even believe this? Why would we care? We all know what's going to happen anyway. Obviously, Roman Reigns is going to dump him out in the Rumble match. That's where this is all leading to. But when they say stupid shit like that, it just, ugh, God, it makes the hair on my neck stand up. I get douche chills. Like, just shut up. Ambrose is still with the doctor backstage doing image association. So he shows Ambrose a picture, and Ambrose has to say the first thing that comes to his head. So Seth Rollins is scumbag. Roman Reigns is brother. Wouldn't it make more sense if Hulk Hogan was in the photo, right? Eh, whatever. Kane is toothpaste, which I guess is supposed to be a joke about Isaac Yankum. Jim Duggan is ho. Stephanie McMahon is a ho. I have to say, the way it was done, that last part, it got a laugh out of me. First time, I think, a bit of comedy on this show has actually gotten a legitimate laugh out of me in, oh God, I don't even know how long. Alicia Fox pinned Naomi, who had one arm tied behind her backside. Her backside. I'm sorry. I just can't help it. She's got a great ass. What am I going to say? It's a compliment. Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman came out for a promo. Brock said nothing. Paul was being Paul. Paul is great at cutting promos, but not his best. I just feel like we've heard the same thing over and over again. It's like, at what point, what do you do? You know, what new can you possibly say when there's really nothing new to comment on? It was just Brock Lesnar should be feared, and it's a triple threat match, and it's not fair, and blah, 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 and that kind of stuff. But Brock was great. He just stood there and looked menacing, and he would smirk every now and then he would look menacing again. Nobody is better at looking menacing in WWE than Brock Lesnar. I will say that. I don't know if that's worth $3 million, but he does a good job at it. Daniel Bryan made his triumphant return to New Orleans, the site of his championship win at last year's WrestleMania, which just feels like a lifetime ago already. He said it's going to be his time at the Royal Rumble. He will win the Rumble. He will go back to the WrestleMania main event to win the championship. Stephanie McMahon came out, told Bryan his first match back would be on SmackDown against Kane. Kane came out and Bryan attacked him all over the ringside area, gave him a flying knee. The key here, for the idiots who still insist, despite all evidence to the contrary, and there aren't many idiots left, I will say, but there are a few. For the people who insist that Daniel Bryan is not over. Daniel Bryan himself is not over. It's just the yes chant that's over. Which is a bullshit argument. Obviously the yes chant is over. But the fans loudly chanted Daniel Bryan's name in this segment. As they did on SmackDown as well. And actually, as I sit here, I just got an email in my inbox. Literally just got an email. I'll have to post this on Twitter. From somebody who apparently has a broken caps lock key. They don't know that when you have the caps lock key on, you're shouting, so the whole thing is in caps. But I love it how in the subject line, I'm not even like finishing reading the rest of his email. This person is clearly deranged and brain damaged and not a fan of my show, just a troll. And in the subject line of the email, I love how it says, "You better answer." That's what it says. It says, "You better answer." So just a free word of advice for all the other deranged idiots that may be out there among us, walking among us, okay? That is a surefire way to make sure that somebody does not read your email when you command them in the subject line that you better do this, you better do that. I don't have to do shit, my friend. And as a matter of fact, I don't even have to finish reading this guy's email. I'm just going to post it so all you guys can read it and you can laugh and point and mock. I know I said last week it's not fun to make fun of brain damaged people, but for this case, I'll make an exception. I'll post this on Twitter and we can all point and laugh. So, back to the show. We have a backstage confrontation between Seth Rollins and Brock Lesnar, who shared a very uncomfortably long stare. Seth called himself the future of WWE. Brock said the future starts when he says it does. I was kind of hoping that he would tell Seth that he's not going to have much of a future if he keeps mouthing off to him that way, but that would actually be cool dialogue, so we can't have that on the show. Heyman stepped in to calm things down. I like this. I mean, it was just unique, I think, to see so much interaction with Brock and somebody other than John Cena. It was kind of refreshing, to be honest with you. And I'm kind of hoping that we have more interaction in the Rumble match between Seth and Brock, with Cena just kind of laying on the outside. Like, when the bell rings, let Lesnar, like, F5 John Cena or give him 10 German suplexes. Get him out of the match for a good 5-10 minutes and just let Brock and Seth go at it. I think the two of them could probably have a pretty incredible match. The way that Seth bumps around for people, even Brock. I don't think Brock gets enough credit for a guy that big, who really doesn't have to sell for anybody if he doesn't want to. He bumps around pretty good. He almost broke his neck last year, bumping off a throw by the Big Show on Raw. I'd love to see these two guys do more. Brie Bella pinned Paige in 2 minutes and 9 seconds, according to the Diva stopwatch, with a distraction roll-up. After Paige got distracted by Tyson Kidd on the outside, who was there with Paige's new BFF, Natalya, I've decided that in addition to the Diva stopwatch, I'm starting something new each week. It'll be just for Raw, since I don't watch all the other shows consistently every week. I just can't handle that. Although Main Event's off the network for the foreseeable future, so that's one less show to worry about. It's going to be called the Raw Roll-Up Counter, specifically for distraction roll-up finishes. So not just any roll-up, not a roll-up that leads to a two count, a distraction roll-up finish is what this counter will be for. We are officially at 3 on the show for the year so far, and it's only been 2 weeks. And by the way, after the match, Paige slapped the shit out of Tyson Kidd, who completely no-sold it, and smiled. And I thought that was awesome. And Tyson was also wearing a shirt that had cats with sunglasses on it. This was even better than that time that Bayley wore that shirt on NXT with the cat sitting on donuts. I must know where Tyson Kidd got this shirt from. I would absolutely order one. Unless it was custom made. The Ascension beat two jobbers again while JBL buried them on commentary. So let's talk a little bit about the Ascension here. On our Facebook group page, Brian McCart, earlier in the week, had a post, and I want to read what he wrote, and then I'm going to give my response to it. Largely because Brian did not say to me, "You better answer." See, so I'm going to answer his question. That's how this works. So Brian said one way to save the Ascension would be for them to face only former champions and squash them. I'm thinking bringing in for one night only teams like Too Cool and the Headbangers. Headbangers, that's a weird one. It could all build to Demolition being inducted, as you said, into the Hall of Fame and appear in the ring on Raw for an announcement. The Ascension rush the ring to beat them down. JBL leaves commentary. Oh, you won me there. As soon as you said that, you got me. JBL leaves commentary for the save. Ron Simmons could also appear. All could include with or conclude, he says, with the Ascension against the APA at WrestleMania. So that was the idea that Brian put forth. It's funny you mention Ron Simmons, because Ron Simmons is one of the legends that is scheduled for a Raw reunion tomorrow night. And I'm sure that's not a coincidence, so I think you may be onto something there. It's not a bad idea. Look, there's no turning back at this point from the comparisons to older teams. So they may as well go all the way with it. I saw a recent match on YouTube with the Powers of Pain. It couldn't have been more than a few years old. Warlord and Barbarian. Now, Warlord is a lot smaller than he was at his peak. He's not gassed to the gills. But they're still huge. These guys are big dudes. They're still in amazingly good shape for their age. They've got to be in their 50s. Maybe even closer to 60. I don't know. So maybe they could do something with them as well. You know, they got name dropped on Raw, too. Before, it was just Demolition and LOD. All of a sudden, on Monday night, I hear the Powers of Pain mentioned, and I happen to see this match where they look to be in great shape. So put two and two together. I don't know if they'll be on Raw Reunion. Maybe they will be, although the Powers of Pain never appeared on Raw. But I would not be shocked at all if we end up seeing the Powers of Pain on TV at some point doing an actual match, because these guys can still go. Maybe the Ascension ends up doing a tag team version of Randy Orton's Legend Killer gimmick. You know, maybe that's where they go with this. The key here, though, is that if they do that, they have to have the Ascension beat the old guys, not the other way around. Otherwise, I don't know what that says for the Ascension if they give them the Heath Slater treatment. Remember Raw 1000 a few years ago? Every week it was a new legend. Vader came out, Sid came out, Lita came out, Doink came out. They all beat Heath Slater. For the Ascension's sake, I hope that's not what they have in mind for them. But I would say that we are very likely to see something happen on Raw this week, probably with Ron Simmons and maybe JBL. So I'm going to take a wait-and-see approach. I'm going to hope that they are building to something, that they have an idea for these guys that might actually be entertaining, because if there's one thing I could say so far about the Ascension, I have not been entertained. I have not been sports entertained by the Ascension so far on this show. We found Dean Ambrose backstage having switched roles with the doctor now. He was laying on the couch, and Dean was evaluating him. The doctor was crying as well, by the way. He also probably realized there was still some time left in the show. Dean convinced him to sign his paper, so he is in the Rumble match. Dean came out for a match with Rusev, which Ambrose promptly lost. What else is new? Referee stopped the match out of concern for the condition of Dean's knee, which had been injured. This man has miraculous healing powers. Does the referee not know this? Does the referee not watch the show? This seems to be a pattern with the people who work there. I don't think they pay enough attention to their own show. The finish was terrible on so many levels. You know, on Twitter, I just posted a tweet that said terrible, and I think people mistook that for my opinion of the show overall. There have been some terrible Raws recently. I wouldn't call this show terrible. I wasn't referring to the show. I was referring to the finish of this match and this segment. This finish was terrible on so many levels. First of all, yet another loss for Dean Ambrose, who is well overdue for a big singles win. He should not be beating Rusev on Raw, so why even make the match? Why put the two of them in a match together when you just know you're going to get a fuck finish? I feel like I've said this before. Here's what's even worse about the whole thing, though, and I don't know how many of you picked up on this. Right after the referee called for the bell, okay, Ambrose, he tried to get to his feet, he collapsed under his own weight. His leg couldn't support the weight. That's when the referee said, that's it, ring the bell, and he called the match off. The match ends, and so what does Dean Ambrose do? He gets back up to his feet to feed for Rusev's super kick and then gets laid out. His knee sure seemed well enough there for him to stand on. He didn't collapse under his own weight then. And I don't know if that was Ambrose's fault, or he just forgot where he wasn't selling, or just not that much thought was put into the finish, which is very possible, but it looked terrible. I mean, I cannot believe how much steam Dean Ambrose has lost with me since that first match that he had with Seth Rollins back at SummerSlam, where Ambrose all of a sudden was one of the hottest guys in the company. And then when Roman Reigns got hurt, which wasn't for another month, Ambrose all of a sudden is in prime position to be a top guy in this company. He headlines Hell in a Cell with Rollins, and then they did that nonsense finish with Bray Wyatt. And I was looking forward to the Dean Ambrose-Bray Wyatt feud. I'm not going to sit here and say they've had no good matches. I said last week I thought their brawl, the ambulance match, was a good brawl. They haven't had... The only bad match, it was bad mainly because of the finish. It wasn't really the match itself, was Survivor Series. After that, the matches they've had, I think, have been good to very good. But I never felt like that Ambrose-Wyatt feud really, you know, kicked it up a notch where it justified the excitement that I had for it. It never reached that level. There was just something that was missing there. And I don't know if it was in the lack of really great promos, if it was in the matches themselves. I don't know. I can't really tell you exactly what it was, but I was left, now that that feud appears to be over, I hope, I was left very underwhelmed by the Ambrose-Wyatt feud. It made Wyatt look strong, but I don't think it did Ambrose any favors at all. Ambrose, I think, is good enough, especially with his promos and how wacky he is, that he'll be okay. But it's another example to me of a guy at a time when you need to push as many new top baby faces as you can. If you can get, like, two guys that are either at the level of a Cena or just below, because I don't think these guys aren't at Cena's level, not yet. But if you've got guys like that and the fans are into them and they're getting over, then fucking push those guys and go all the way with them, because God knows we can use some real top new blood in that main event picture. And they've got these guys in that position, but I just feel like they're not doing them any favors with this booking. It just kind of boggles my mind. I'm not really sure what the rationale is for. Who the fuck knows? Maybe they're going to turn Ambrose heel and it doesn't matter. Who knows? So the main event was a contract signing for the championship match at the Royal Rumble. We had Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman out there. The Authority was out there. Seth Rollins, John Cena. Heyman, during his spiel, brought up how Brock Lesnar did not have to be pinned or submitted to lose the title. Very unfair to Brock Lesnar. Seth Rollins says he's walking out of the Rumble with the championship. Paul Heyman goes to take the microphone. Brock Lesnar, however, cuts him off. It's always dangerous when Brock takes the mic. I always think of that meme where I think Brock and Heyman were in the ring with Shawn Michaels back in the day, whatever it was. And Lesnar just took the mic out of Heyman's hands, and Heyman has this look on his face, and then he puts his head in his hands, like, uh-oh, this is not going to end well. And I always think that. You never know what you're going to get when Brock Lesnar takes the mic. I thought this was a good night for him on the mic. He didn't say much, but he didn't, you know, he came off fine. He took the mic, and he says he conquered the Undertaker streak. He says, I conquered this guy, pointing at Triple H. I conquered this guy, pointing at John Cena. Someone capped the exact moment that Brock Lesnar pointed at Triple H and said that he conquered him, and the look on Hunter's face is just priceless. He would bury the man with 1,000 shovels at that moment if he could. Anyway, they all signed the contract. Rollins goes to hit Cena with the briefcase because it's a contract signing. It can never go off without a hitch. Cena counters into an AA attempt, but Brock Lesnar sneaks up from behind, gives Cena a German suplex. Then he gives one to Seth Rollins. Cena pops back up, puts Brock in the AA, puts him through a table. Rollins then attacks Cena, gives him a curb stomp, which Cena sells horrendously, as he usually does. He's practically standing when he takes this curb stomp. He probably is the one guy on the roster who I would say is the worst that I've seen at taking the curb stomp. And he's the top guy, so think about that. On the other hand, Brock Lesnar, that fucker takes the curb stomp like a champ. Just like at Night of Champions, this was even better. He even drew some blood on it, too. He had like a nice welt on his forehead. He had his face smashed into the ground, and he did not look happy. So Brock Lesnar is angry, heading into the go-home show this week, which is Raw Reunion. And actually, before I get to Raw Reunion, let me just say this. There were a lot of people online saying, why didn't Seth Rollins cash in? Why didn't he cash in his money in the bank? It doesn't make any sense. I'll actually defend WWE on this, and I'll argue that it makes absolute sense why he wouldn't cash in. I never once thought to myself, how come this guy's not cashing in? And the reason is because they're heading into a triple threat match at the Royal Rumble. If we are to assume that this match, which they have now signed the contract for, so it almost doesn't even matter who the champion is going in. The contracts have been signed. This triple threat match is happening no matter what at the Royal Rumble. If we are to assume that, let us say that Seth Rollins cashes in at that moment after he curb stomps Lesnar and he pins him, and Seth Rollins wins the WWE Championship. And he has no briefcase because he cashed in. He's got the title, okay? Well, now Seth Rollins goes to the Royal Rumble to defend his championship against a pissed off Brock Lesnar and John Cena, who has Seth Rollins' number. John Cena has far more wins over Seth Rollins than the other way around. And it's a match where Seth doesn't even have to be pinned. He doesn't even have to be beaten to lose his title. And if he loses his title, he's got no briefcase. And if you assume that by being in the championship match, that also means that Rollins is not in the Royal Rumble match. So why exactly is it so outrageous that Seth Rollins would not cash in on this show? I think it's much better to hold on to the briefcase at this point. You've already got a title match. Seth is very confident in his own abilities. He actually thinks he's going to win this fucking match. So why waste the briefcase on Raw? Why? Why would he do that? It actually doesn't make sense, I argue, in that scenario for him to cash in. This way, he's got a title match already. He still has the briefcase as insurance. If he doesn't win the championship in the triple threat match, guess what? He still has the briefcase. He can cash in that night. He can cash in at WrestleMania. He can cash in on Raw the next night. He can cash in whenever he wants. But that's the key, I think. If he cashes in last Monday and he wins, he's got no briefcase, but he still has to put his title on the line against two guys in a match where he doesn't even have to get beat. That makes no sense. So let's put that argument to bed, shall we? Raw reunion this Monday will have Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Shawn Michaels, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash has been added to the show now that the charges against him have been dropped. He has been unsuspended. In the graphic, they have him as Diesel, although I don't know that that means he'll be there as Diesel. I would assume it'll be the Wolfpack or, you know, NWO, but they did have him as Diesel in the graphic. Sean Waltman, X-Pac, is going to be there. He's been added to the show. And again, New Age Outlaws are going to be there. Ron Simmons is going to be there. A bunch of others who I'm sure they'll trot the usual suspects out. Hacksaw Jim Duggan or Sergeant Slaughter. I do wish they would give us some more variety with some of these guys. I mean, who knows? Maybe we'll get Demolition. Who knows? We never see Demolition. They've been persona non grata for years in that company, going back to when Axe sued Vince McMahon. They had a whole dispute over the rights to who owned the Demolition gimmick. But, yeah, it'd be nice for them to trot out some guys we don't see all the time. Maybe they will. I also just want to say something real quick about SmackDown. I did watch SmackDown. I did. And my opinion has not changed on SmackDown. It is a useless show. They will try to make it important these first few weeks. Daniel Bryan, they hyped up his return. I watched the show because I wanted to see what they did with him. He wrestled twice on the show. He had a match with Kane, and then they brought both of them back for a six-man tag in the main event. WWE sure does love their six-man tags. And it was Bryan, Roman Reigns, and Dean Ambrose against Seth Rollins, Kane, and I think it was the Big Show. And they're actually hyping a rematch with Bryan and Kane, not for Raw. They're hyping it for SmackDown. So they actually hyped the match a week in advance for SmackDown and are resisting the urge to put it on Raw, which I'm very impressed by. Stipulation is that if Bryan loses to Kane, if he fails to win next Thursday, then he is out of the Royal Rumble match. I guarantee you, give it a few more weeks, and SmackDown is going to be as forgotten as it was before. I mean, that's just how it is, you know? So I'm not planning on watching SmackDown every single week. My routine is Thursday nights, I watch NXT. I order in some Chinese, and I watch NXT for an hour. It's an easy hour of wrestling. Now NXT is on Wednesdays. Thank God they have it on demand. So I'm sticking to my routine, and if anything important happens in a given week on SmackDown, that's what DVR is for. But I thought the show overall, it was okay. I mean, the Bryan stuff, I thought Bryan looked good. He looked like the Bryan of old. There didn't seem to be a whole lot of ring rust on him. He did the toe-pay through the ropes and everything else. I don't think he did the drop kick off the top, unless I'm just forgetting. If I were him, I would just save that for big matches on pay-per-views and stuff. That's not a move he should be doing. So I thought the Bryan stuff was fine, and other than that, I can't even remember what else happened on the show. It was just... Actually, there was an interview segment with Heyman and Rollins, and that was kind of good, but Otherwise, I certainly was not left thinking, man, SmackDown now is must-see TV. No, SmackDown's what it always is. They put Brian on there to get in some new viewers. It was a smart move on their part. And in a few more weeks, none of this will matter. Speaking of NXT, this was the first episode on Wednesday night of NXT, which I actually did watch on Wednesday night, just for the first week. So Wednesday nights at 8 p.m., I believe, is the official start time, but you can just watch it whenever you want to on demand. Finn Balor and Tyson Kidd opened the show with a match. Unfortunately, I missed the first 5 or 6 minutes of this, and I never did go back and watch it. But from what I saw, this was a really good match, and Balor won in the end with a double foot stomp off the top rope. This guy's got money written all over him. And I saw that picture, by the way, he posted on his Twitter. I don't know if it was at a house show and somebody gave him a replica belt and he posed with it, or if it was Photoshopped or what the deal is. But it was a photo of Finn Balor holding the WWE World Heavyweight Championship belt. It had the older logo on it, so maybe it was a replica that somebody gave him. But all I could think when I looked at that photo was, this works. He actually looks good with the belt, and I think I think I've said this before, but I'm going to make a not-so-bold prediction here. WrestleMania 33. Mark that down. WrestleMania 33 in the main event. I don't know if it'll be Balor and Cena, whatever it is. I think we're going to see WWE Championship gold on this guy. He's got all the tools. He's not the biggest guy in the world, and maybe, who knows, maybe his accent will work against him. I mean, after all, Vince McMahon seems to think that the reason Cesaro didn't connect with the crowd is because maybe he's Swiss. So, oh my God, if Finn Balor has an accent, what will we do? What will the American fans do? How will we understand him if he's not using that wonderful American dialect? I have no idea. We got the Battle of the Bulls. Actually, one was a bull, the other was a baron. A baron and a bull. Baron Corbin and Bull Dempsey had their first encounter, and it went about 90 seconds, which may be the longest Baron Corbin match we've seen on television yet. Baron Corbin got the win with the End of Days, which actually looked pretty impressive. Bull Dempsey is not a small man. He's not tall, but I would not call Bull Dempsey a small man. And Baron Corbin got him up. It looked good. He dropped him like a bad habit with the End of Days and got the pin. That was after Bull missed a flying headbutt off the top rope. I would think that this is not the end of it. They'll keep it going. I don't know if Bull will ever get a win over Baron Corbin, but I'd like to see this thing go a little bit longer. You know, see the guys cutting promos on each other to see how they sound and what the promos are like, and have a match that actually goes maybe 5 minutes. Maybe, you know, put the two of them on the next NXT special in a no disqualification match, and you can bring weapons in and stuff like that. I'd like to see what the two of them can do. I know that the card for the next NXT special is already floating out there. They had tapings this past week. I don't look at the NXT spoilers, so I don't know what the card is. I can surmise what, you know, for example, the main event is. I'm sure it's Sami Zayn against Kevin Owens for the title or something. But I'm just saying, you know, another match, one more to really finish the feud with Baron Corbin and Bull Dempsey, I think is something that makes sense, and maybe have some kind of gimmick match. We don't get very many gimmick matches in NXT, so when you have one, it kind of means more. It's okay. They don't abuse it. We're not getting hardcore matches every week on TV and disqualification finishes on TV every single week, which plays into the main event on this show, actually. We'll get to that in a second. Sasha Banks and Becky Lynch, team by BAE, best at everything, beat Charlotte and Natalya when Sasha nailed Charlotte with a neck breaker and rolled her up with a fistful of tights. Ever the great heel, Sasha Banks. So they are keeping Sasha strong. I mean, it looks like she's positioned for another title shot. You know, I don't know how many times you can go back to that well. She's had two matches. She lost two matches. But she got the win here. Main event was Sami Zayn against Adrian Neville in an NXT TakeOver rematch for the championship. Sami Zayn pinned Adrian Neville off the Huluva kick to retain the NXT title in a very good match. There were a couple of Hurricane Ranas in this match where it looked like Sami Zayn had his head just spiked into the mat. Brutal. Just brutal to watch. He was acting like he might be concussed after them. He went for his wacky move later in the match where from the outside he runs and dives through the turnbuckles into a twisting DDT. But as he went to dive under the turnbuckles, Neville had him scouted. And he pasted him right in the face with a super kick. Awesome counter. Sammy ended up getting the pin after the Huluva kick, like I said, so they are putting his finish over strong. That's two straight clean pinfall wins for the champion over Adrian Neville. No bullshit DQ finish just because, well, it's the TV, it's the weekly show. So we could do bullshit DQ finishes because it builds to the pay-per-view match. No, you know what? It's actually kind of nice that we got clean finishes on this show. We got a clean finish in the main event here. We got a clean finish probably in every match, I think, on the show except Sasha hooking the tights. But that's one of the other things that's so refreshing about this show. They don't beat you over the head with a fucking DQ fuck finish nonsense every single week. Just to justify that it's okay to do that because it's building to a clean finish on the next special. It's a little harder to justify something like that with NXT when you only have like four specials every year. So they gave us a clean finish, and guess what? Both guys came out of this, I thought, looking strong. Adrian Neville didn't come out of it looking like a loser. It was a competitive match, and he got beat. The better man won. That's the way it should be. Now, Kevin Owens did run in, but it was after the match. And again, that's the key here. They gave us that clean, decisive finish to the match before the run-in. And it makes sense, because Kevin Owens, he doesn't give a shit about either guy. He doesn't care about Sami Zayn. He doesn't care about Adrian Neville. He doesn't want to see either guy win the match. So why interfere and hand a DQ win to Sami, who he hates? And he hoisted Sami up into the air, caught him coming down for a powerbomb. He put his foot on Sami's neck, kept it there for a while like he was going to snap it. Total heel heat for Kevin Owens here. No smarky cheers from the crowd at Full Sail. The guy is just really good at being an evil SOB, not somebody cool who the people can cheer for. So basically the opposite of most of the NWO back in the day. And that's how they went off the air. Another good hour. Obviously they're building to Zayn and Owens, I assume, for the championship next month. To me, it almost supersedes the title here. This is like a blood feud where it should be like just a big grudge match. Put them in the freaking parking lot at Full Sail. Let them go at it. Maybe not for their first match. Maybe that'll be the second match. But I'm looking forward to what these two guys can do. We've seen what they can do in Ring of Honor. We've seen what these two guys can do on the indies. They're a little more restrained now. They can't just go out there and have that same kind of match and show up everybody else and use weapons and have blood in crazy spots. But I don't doubt that these two guys, as much as they've worked together and as friendly as they are going to go out there and just tear the freaking house down. So I'm looking forward to that. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. I got a lot more to get into with TNA, with Lucha Underground, including some big news that broke this weekend on that, and a humongous mailbag. We got like 10 questions in the mailbag. So take a listen to this real quick. We'll be right back. ProWrestlingTees.com is your one-stop shop for all things Sound Off. We've got a ton of different t-shirt designs up there right now, including the official Sound Off logo shirt, the Eat Sleep Sound Off repeat shirt, and original designs as well, like Let Me School You, Son, and It's Not Rocket Science, people. And it's not rocket science that you should go right now to our store, ProWrestlingTees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off, and get yourself a shirt, maybe two. They ship all over the world, so if you are an international fan of the show, fear not, you can get your own Sound Off shirt. You can also pay via credit card or PayPal, whatever works best for you. So head on over to ProWrestlingTees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off. Buy yourself a Sound Off shirt, and the next time you go to Monday Night Raw, TNA, Ring of Honor, or just out with the family, you can represent the Sound Off with an official Sound Off t-shirt. Again, visit ProWrestlingTees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off and get your shirt right now. I watched Impact on Friday night, had to bust out my night vision goggles again for the show just to make sure there were actual people in the crowd. I could hear them, but I couldn't see them. Although I did end up seeing myself at ringside, which was very surprising to me because the shows that I was at are not airing until the end of the month. So they were either airing segments out of order again or just took crowd shots. What I think probably happened here is they took crowd shots from the later tapings, like probably from the night that we were there. Because our crowd was the most packed, and they just splice them in there. Josh Matthews and Taz were shown doing commentary from a studio in Nashville. In fact, they went not only at the beginning of the show, but back to them numerous times. They would have a split screen, and they would show them watching the show as though we're watching the show. And they're sitting in a booth somewhere in Nashville, Tennessee. So they're not even trying to pretend that they're there live. You know, at least they're being honest, I guess, but as a viewer, I gotta tell you, this came off as really, really lame to me, and just very amateurish. you know, New Japan, okay? New Japan Pro Wrestling aired a match on their first show this week. I was able to see the show on Access Television. I don't have the network, but the link got sent to me by somebody. Somebody uploaded it somewhere. I didn't feel too guilty about it. It wasn't a pay-per-view, so I was like, I'm going to watch this show. And I opened the link, and I watched it. It was the full hour, and it was all based around a match that was 2 years old. And they edited new American commentary into the show from Josh Barnett and Mauro Ranallo that was so awesome. It was so awesome. You would have thought that Mauro and Josh were there live, the way that they called this match. They didn't beat you over the head with the fact that they were sitting in a studio calling a match that was 2 years old. With TNA, it just comes off as lame. And that's kind of how I felt here. They came back from a commercial break at one point, and they actually had on camera Taz and Matthews are talking to like one of the directors of the show, you know, as though they don't know they're back from break, and then they're like, all right, we got it, go, and then they kind of go back to their voiceover. It's like, what the hell is this? Like, I guess this is supposed to be like one of the more realistic elements of the show. I mean, look, if you want to do that kind of stuff on like one of the weekend recap shows, be my guest. I just thought watching Impact, while I can appreciate them trying new things, to me this didn't work. This just came off as more lame than anything else. We had MVP, Kenny King, and Lowkey, and Samoa Joe out early in the show. They are called the Beatdown Clan, as I mentioned last week. As if that name isn't ridiculous enough, and it is one of the worst names of a faction I've ever heard. Samoa Joe flat out looked into the camera later on. I think it was after his match with Angle, or maybe it was during the match. He just looked dead into the camera and he mouthed the words Beatdown Crew. So apparently he doesn't know the name of his own group. That's like Hulk Hogan calling the NWO the New World Organization at one point, very early on when they first started. Eric Young, I'm trying to keep track of this. Eric Young is apparently not part of the Beatdown Clan. He turned heel, but he's flying solo. He said he turned on Bobby Roode because Roode never gave him a shot at the TNA title. And then he said Bobby Roode never visited him when he was laid up in the hospital. When the fuck was Eric Young laid up in the hospital? What did I miss something here? I have no recollection of this. And the title shot thing, what a lame excuse. You know, lame. I'm happy that they've got Joe and Lowkey in the main storyline now doing something meaningful on television. Those guys are really good. But turning people for the sake of turning people is the same old shit that we're used to seeing from TNA. And these explanations were setting off my bullshit detector as I watched this. I'm like, bullshit, lame, bullshit. I mean, that's the best they could come up with, really? Kurt Angle came out. And all of this led to a match with him and Joe. That at least got me excited. Kurt Angle against Samoa Joe is a match to get excited for. The match, as it turned out, was okay. It was not anything like their matches of old. You know, with Angle in his current state, it's probably expecting too much. But Joe kicked him in the balls behind the referee's back and got Angle to tap out cleanly in the reverse naked choke. Kind of surprising, but at least Kane didn't fucking run in for the disqualification. I can appreciate that. Kurt Angle, he tapped out cleanly to another man. Maybe not cleanly, he got kicked in the balls, but as cleanly as you would ever see Kurt Angle tap out. He tapped out to another man. How often does that happen? You know, now surely that would mean that Samoa Joe now is in line for a championship match, right? I wouldn't hold my breath on that. The Hardys and the Wolves had a really good match. James Storm and his Revolution group were watching from up in the balcony. You'd think they were the only people in the audience, as dark as the rest of the building was, and they put a spotlight on those guys. You would never know anybody else was there. They could have piped in a fucking noise track for all we know. And just sprinkle people in the first like one or two rows, and you would never know there was more than that there. Hardy's won with a new move. I didn't get the name of it, but it's basically a powerbomb into a neckbreaker combo. Matt pinned Eddie Edwards. If you watch nothing else from this show, watch this match. This was the best thing on the entire show. One of the best matches of the week, in fact. They're doing the Feast or Fired gimmick next week, so somebody's getting fired. EC3 challenged a bald Jeremy Borash to a match next week. I have to say, one of the most entertaining things at the tapings that we were at last week were the reactions that Jeremy Borash had to EC3 whenever he came out to the ring, even though none of it is likely to air on television. You know, Borash, he'd put the middle finger up, he'd flip him off, he'd be mouthing like, you know, fuck you, fuck this motherfucker, like going crazy. We're like, JB, calm down. Borash is very good in the role. He's very good at playing whatever role this is that he's playing, so I guess we'll have to see how this supposed match plays itself out next week. And remember also, EC3, he ain't wrestling. He's not wrestling anytime soon. He's not wrestling next week either, because he just had surgery for a torn bicep or tricep, whatever it is. He's nowhere close being ready to come back and competing yet. Eric Young and Bobby Roode had a match one-on-one. They brawled in the crowd. They brawled into the ring. And in the end, Eric Young gave him a pile driver on top of a steel chair that looked pretty brutal, and he pinned him. Beautiful People beat Brooke Tessmacher and Taryn Terrell when Velvet Sky rolled up Brooke with a schoolgirl for the pin. Beautiful People and the Bromans now carry a selfie stick to the ring with them. That's a real thing, by the way. If there is a more douchey item that has ever been created, I would love for you to show it to me so that way I can break it in half. These are real things, though. There was an article just recently I read about selfie sticks. I could tell those people what they could do with their sticks. Speaking of broken in half, lights went out after the match, and when they came back on, Awesome Kong was in the ring. She laid out Angelina and Velvet, then chokeslammed DJ Zima, folded him up like an accordion. And then, do younger fans even know what an accordion is? I catch myself every now and then using that phrase, but do people really know? Like, if you're in high school right now, or junior high school, do you know what an accordion is? Maybe you do. Maybe I'm just an idiot, but sounds to me like we probably have a bunch of people listening to this show that may have never even seen an accordion in their entire life. I never see them anymore. Unless I'm watching, like, a fucking polka dance special somewhere on, I don't even, probably air on Destination America or something like that. Havoc came out and had a stare down with Kong to end the segment. Low Key beat Austin Aries to win back the X Division title just 1 week after losing it, so Austin Aries' sixth title run ends very prematurely. The Beatdown Clan ran down, Aries fended them off, but got crotched on the top rope by Kenny King. That allowed Low Key to hoist up Aries for the Key Crusher and the win. After the match, MVP was in the ring with the crew and Eric Young, who isn't part of the group. Remember that. We're told he's not part of the group. But everywhere the fucking Beatdown Clan goes, apparently there's Eric Young. He's always out there with them. So does that make him not part of the... How does that not make him part of the group? I'd love to know. MVP called Bobby Lashley down to the ring. MVP took credit for Lashley winning the title back from Bobby Roode last week and said the title belonged to everybody in the Beatdown Clan. Lashley disagreed, said the title belongs to him. MVP tried to smooth things over. He hugged Lashley. I think he kissed him, too. And then the clan attacked, and they all started beating up Bobby Lashley. I feel weird even saying that the clan attacked this black man in the ring, but that's what happened. They all took turns kicking Lashley's ass. Lashley juiced, so we got some blood. And then MVP stole the title and said it belongs to them. So after months of teasing a split between Lashley and MVP, this was, I think, a lame payoff. You see a recurring word with this show here, lame. I'm not really saying it's terrible, I'm just saying it's lame. That's how I felt coming out of all these key angles on this show. Lame, lame, lame. The people didn't care at all. They did show some highlights of a street fight literally in the streets of New York City next week between Lashley and MVP, which I think was taped the next night. So at least that looks pretty cool, actually. It depends how much fighting they actually do out on 34th Street there. That actually looked pretty cool. But the whole heel stable deal in TNA is so overdone. It's so overdone. We lost the Aces and Eights, finally, and now we've got the Beatdown Clan. And as a group, I'm not even saying they're a terrible group, and it gets some of them in the main event picture, but, you know, it took turning a bunch of guys for no fucking reason to get there. If you've got a real good, legit reason for somebody to turn, then do it. But that's TNA's problem. They'll just turn people for the sake of turning. You know what? I give WWE a lot of credit. in that for years. People have been telling them, turn John Cena heel. John Cena has to turn heel. Why won't they turn him heel? And they stick to their guns. They will not turn John Cena. TNA, you don't have to tell them to turn somebody. They'll turn somebody in hour one, and they'll turn him back in hour two. And it's no wonder that people just don't care. I mean, Eric Young was a babyface for so long. He was this underdog babyface. He was like the Daniel Bryan of TNA, the closest thing they have to a Daniel Bryan in TNA. And then they established this whole relationship with him and Bobby Roode. And then Eric Young turns, and it's like, does anybody even care? Did anybody even bat an eyelash that this big babyface Eric Young turned heel? I don't think anybody cares. It's just this feeling of apathy. It's this lame feeling like, ugh, why did they do that? That kind of pervades TNA right now, and I think, unfortunately for them, that's the common denominator here, is that just nobody cares. We'll see how many people really cared when the ratings come in for this show. It was interesting. I saw that Ring of Honor, what Ring of Honor averages for their show, which I think is in the 4 to 450,000 range, they actually outdrew TNA on their first show. Now, it's their first show on a new network, so I said last week, and even the TNA bashers were like, oh, what do you mean it doesn't matter? I said, take that first number and throw it away. It doesn't matter. The only number that matters is the number they do in their normal spot. Their normal spot is not Wednesday night like it was last week. It's Fridays. And even then, I think you got to give them 2-3 weeks, and then you'll know what the impact audience is going to look like. So we don't know. We don't know what this first Friday number is going to look like, and it's not even going to be as important as the number 3 weeks from now. But it's interesting that already Ring of Honor is officially outdrawing TNA on television. I did not think that would happen, but apparently it already has. So there you go. Lucha Underground. Let's talk a little bit about Lucha Underground. This was episode 10. We had a really fun show. It was a three-match show. There were three matches on the entire show, all of which were at least good. And in some cases, they were a fucking shit ton of fun, including the opener. The opener was Aerostar, who's a new guy we haven't seen before, I don't think, Argenis, Angelico, and Cage, which is the former Brian Cage. He's been with PWG. I think he did the gut check thing in TNA, and he was on Impact for a while before they just decided not to use him, I guess. He is a big, jacked-up monster of a dude that you don't want to fuck with. I mean, he's a big guy, but he's also very agile. It's not like he's a big guy who's slow, and he's got two left feet, and he can't work. He can work, but he also happens to be just monstrous. And I thought the way they did this was just awesome. So they have a four-way match. It's an elimination match. Cage comes in. I'm skipping ahead towards the end here. Cage comes in towards the end and does a power bomb, and he takes out Argenis, so he's gone. He takes out Aerostar with a power bomb. He gave Angelico a buckle bomb in the corner and then another power bomb, so they're all gone, and Cage is the winner. He's the last man standing. He took out Angelico. Actually, I think he beat Angelico with a clothesline. I think it was a lariat. But anyway, the finishing sequence in this match was actually really great. And the other thing about this match was you had four guys. I think all four were brand new. I think this was probably the debut for all four, not just Cage. Although they built this up as the debut of Cage because he's the one getting a push. It was a really fun match, but everybody got time to shine here. Lots of crazy dives, obviously, all the spots you would expect. But in the end, it was a showcase for Cage, who, in one episode, his debut, went from being an unknown that we've never seen before, on this show at least, to probably being the top heel on the entire show. You know, as you see at the end, which we'll get to in a second with what happened. So I thought everybody looked good here. They all got squashed in the end by Cage, but that was the point. That was how this whole thing was designed. But I still think everybody came out looking pretty good here in this match. Chavo Guerrero had a sit-down in the ring with Blue Demon Jr. It looked like Chavo was feigning, apologizing to him for everything that he had done. He goes, I apologize. And of course it was horseshit. He says, I forgot what he said. I try not to pay attention to what Chavo says. I'm sorry, he just does nothing for me. It was a bullshit apology, and I think he went to attack Blue Demon. Blue Demon ended up attacking Chavo with the chair, which was payback for Chavo attacking him with the chair and attacking Sexy Star with the chair. And he chased off Chavo with the chair, and I think Matt Stryker on commentary said, well, that ends the feud for now, so I guess that's the end of the feud. We had Drago and King Cuerno. I think this might this probably was the third meeting, I think, between them. So anyway, Deerhead Dude grabs a table from under the ring. I'm skipping ahead to the only part of the match that even matters. What happened here was just insane. So Cuerno grabs a table from under the ring, sets it up on the outside. He then grabs a chair. He gets caught with a super kick, so he gets laid out on the table. So even though he set the table up, he's the one now laying on the table. Okay, visualize this. In the second most insane balcony dive I've seen on this show since it started, the first one being that time that John Morrison leapt from the balcony all the way into the ring like a crazy man, Drago runs up the stairs. Okay, if you've watched Lucha Underground, you know there's two entranceways. There's an actual entranceway, and then there's like a staircase that comes through the crowd. Drago runs up the staircase, and now he's up. He walks over to the balcony area. There's like a little ledge in the balcony area where you can do your dives. And he dives off the balcony, and he crashes through Cuerno and the table down below. And when he hit the floor, he didn't just hit the floor, he went splat on the floor, face first. It looked like it sucked to be him on the receiving end of that dive. It looked like he killed Cuerno, it looked like he killed himself, he killed the poor table. It was nuts. So they ruled the match a double countout, they brought stretchers out for both guys. This was insanity. This was an insane spot. I was never a big fan of New Jack and the old ECW and doing all the balcony dives and everything like that. But I would never deny that that guy was a crazy SLB doing that kind of stuff. And in fact, I'm sure he probably fucked up his ankles a whole bunch of times, landing on his feet, jumping off from that high. So this was an insane spot. I don't know how smart it was. This, at least he didn't land on his feet and his ankles. He just went crashing through the table. I would have hated to be the person laying on that table. So if you can find it on YouTube or wherever, I don't know if they put this spot on their official YouTube channel, find it. It's just, the impact was just, ugh, crazy. Main event, Prince Puma and Phoenix for the Lucha Underground Championship. If I had to pick the two guys on the roster at Lucha Underground that I would say are the most spectacular performers they have, it would probably be Prince Puma and Phoenix. We know what Prince Puma can do. If you've ever seen Ricochet on the Indies, the guy is crazy. He's out of his mind. The things he can do defy physics. Okay, he's an amazing performer. Phoenix, I only know him from Lucha Underground. I didn't know of him before that. What I've seen of him, he's also incredible. You put the two of them together, you put a title on the line, you're going to get a great match. That's what this was. It was an incredible match. I would say find it, watch it, enjoy it, bask in all of its glory. I guess if you're the kind of person who doesn't really like the Lucha Libre style with the dives and it's just a bunch of spot monkeys. You do get a lot of that in this match, I'm not going to lie. So you may not enjoy the match, but everybody else, I think, will enjoy it. I'm not going to even attempt to recap the entire thing. I'll talk about the final sequence here. Phoenix went for a sit-down pile driver. Puma reversed it into one of his own. He climbed to the top rope. Unfortunately for Puma, he got caught with a palm thrust, the old CJ Parker palm thrust. Now, picture this, okay? Phoenix climbs to the top rope on the same side of the ring, okay, but in the opposite corner. He's not across. He's on the same side, but in the opposite corner. He proceeds to run the ropes. He's running across the top rope, and as he reaches Puma, he eats a super kick. Puma super kicks him in the face, and then hits the 630 splash for the pin. So you have to see it to really appreciate it for how awesome it was. So Puma wins. He retains the Lucha Underground Championship that he only first won last week. Really fun match. This and the opener both. And the only other match on the show had that crazy dive that I talked about. So I would say this is a must-see show if you can track it down. I'd call this a thumbs-way-up show. Cage did come out after the main event. He laid out Prince Puma, so after just one night, they have established that this guy, Cage, is a force to be reckoned with. And like I said, arguably now the top heel in the promotion. I mean, you could say Mil Muertes. He wasn't on the show this week, but I would say, based on this performance, Cage is probably the number one guy. Now, there's a little spoiler alert here. If you don't want to know any sort of Lucha Underground spoiler, they just had a bunch of tapings. This won't air until the beginning of next month. Skip ahead if you don't want to hear it. But they did have tapings this weekend. And last night, Alberto El Patron made his Lucha Underground debut, the former Alberto Del Rio. Again, I think it airs at the beginning of February. Dave Meltzer says, this is amazing to me. I saw a note. Dave Meltzer said that TNA offered Del Rio $400,000 a year. 400 grand a year with minimal dates. And he still declined. I assume now that he's signed with Lucha Underground, he's in ROH, I assume that just closes the door on TNA. He turned that deal down. What does that say, first of all, about TNA, that, you know, a guy would turn down a deal like that from them? But second of all, I want to know what the fuck TNA is doing offering Del Rio 400 grand for minimum dates when they seemingly can't pay their own electric bill to keep the lights on. I mean, Jesus Christ, I heard that. I was like, no wonder this company is in the shape that it's in. And of all the people to offer a deal like that to, you're going to offer that kind of money? No offense to Del Rio. He's a great wrestler, but is he really worth $400,000 a year for minimal dates in the shape that TNA is in, where they can't even pay to put the fucking lights on? And you know how many people they lost that they can't even pay to have under contract because they can't afford to pay them? What happened to all those guys? Where's Homicide at, huh? Where's the Menagerie? Are they all gone? Haven't seen them, I think, since Impact came back. I just was blown away. My mind was blown when I heard that. Where are they even coming up with the money? How could they even make an offer like that? Why would they make an offer like that? I mean, really, they had Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Sting, all of these guys you have to imagine were making at least that much, if not probably well more than that, and not one of them made a damn bit of difference to TNA in the long run. Not one. You think giving that money to fucking Alberto Del Rio is going to change your fortunes around? It's amazing to me. It's just amazing. Time for the mailbag. We have a lot of questions to get through this week. And by the way, I don't know if I mentioned this here before, but there is a Sound Off inbox that went up about a week ago now? 2 weeks? I think it was about a week ago. If you missed it, it's front and center right now on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/TheSolomonster. It's almost 90 minutes long, just answering nothing but your questions. So if you want to head over there and check it out, if you missed it, go ahead and do so. A lot of good questions from you guys, and I hope to do another inbox very soon. Please include your name and where you are from when you email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. This first question comes from Connecticut, from Dimitri. In light of hearing that Macho Man is going into the Hall of Fame this year, why do people think the Hall of Fame is a joke? Sure, there's no physical hall to celebrate these men and women, but there's a beautiful acceptance ceremony that allows the inductees to give a heartfelt speech about their life. As a physical recognition for their accomplishments, they receive a stunning Hall of Fame ring, which the inductees assuredly cherish forever. Well, unless your name is Billy Graham, and then you sell your Hall of Fame ring. Yet still people scoff at the concept, saying it doesn't mean anything, but at the same time are angered by the fact that guys like Savage are not inducted. Well, I will give you that. That is kind of silly. There is a double standard there. You can't be overly angry that somebody isn't in the Hall of Fame if you think it doesn't mean anything. But I will tell Dimitri this. I am one of those people who has made the comment that the Hall of Fame is. I don't think I've called it a joke. Maybe the process. The process is a joke. But I've said that it really doesn't mean anything. And I would say, let me amend that. Okay, let me explain what I mean when I say that, because you're right, that's not entirely true. The Hall of Fame absolutely means something to the inductees. If nothing else, if you are a wrestler who still does indies and makes convention appearances, as many of those guys still do, being able to advertise yourself as a WWE Hall of Famer, okay, and have that on the poster, means that you may be able to charge the promoter more money. You may sell more 8x10s at the autograph table. So from a purely business standpoint, it does mean something. And yes, it is a nice ceremony with great speeches. Bobby Heenan and Jake Roberts are the best of the bunch as far as I'm concerned. When Bobby Heenan got choked up at the end of his speech and said that he wished that Monsoon was there to see him get inducted, I got a frog in my throat. But people need to understand that the Hall of Fame is simply a marketing tool for WWE to make a shit ton of money every year. They had small ceremonies every year from 1993 until, I believe, 1996. And then they let almost an entire decade go by without inducting anybody. Anybody. Until they finally figured out a way to monetize it. And then they brought it back. You're in business to make money, so no problem, okay? Fine. Smart move on their part. But it still exists at the whims of one man. One man. And that is Vince McMahon. There is no voting committee. They may take suggestions from some of the wrestlers, but they're not the ones making the call. It's Vince McMahon. And if one year you happen to be on the company's shit list, then you may not get that phone call. You know, years ago, they tried to get the Honky Tonk Man to go in, I think when they had that WrestleMania in Phoenix, because he lives in the area. But he had a scheduling conflict. He said he turned them down because of it. They haven't asked him since. The way I look at it, with any real Hall of Fame, if you deserve to go in, you're voted in. That's how it should work. That's how the Baseball Hall of Fame works. That's how most of them work. Okay, even the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. Shout out to Mauro Ranallo during his commentary on the first New Japan show on Access Television. He even dropped a little reference to the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. Okay, that's a big deal. Now, there's no physical hall. It's just a newsletter, but what makes it special is that it's voted on by people in the business. You can subscribe to whatever newsletter you want. You can subscribe to the Observer. That doesn't give you a vote in the Hall of Fame voting. The Hall of Fame voting is voted on by wrestlers or journalists, photographers, whatever. If you're in the wrestling business, you get a ballot. You can vote. If you get in because your own peers voted you in. And then you have things like, you know, the stuff with Lawler, for example. Lawler went into the Hall of Fame, what, was it 2007? I think it was the same year that Jim Ross went in. And when he was inducted, he wanted Lance Russell to do the induction. Because Lance Russell was instrumental in getting Lawler into the wrestling business in the first place. Lawler used to draw illustrations. Lawler was and is still an awesome artist. He's a tremendous artist. That's how he got his start in wrestling. He would draw, I think, posters and stuff and send the artwork in, and it caught Lance Russell's eye. And the rest, as they say, is history. And eventually he started wrestling and became one of the biggest stars of all time. So yeah, I think it's safe to say that Lance Russell had a pretty big influence on the career of Jerry Lawler. Plus, you know, Lance Russell in his own right, he's a legendary announcer. He's one of the best. And Jerry Lawler rightfully thought, you know, it would mean a lot to have Lance Russell do the induction for me. And then you have Kevin Dunn, supposedly, as the one, who nixes the whole thing. Because nobody's going to know who Lance Russell is. Let's have Captain Kirk do the induction. Because, you know, he appeared in one segment with you 12 years ago. Goofy motherfucker. I don't even know why I give Kevin Dunn the whole Southern drawl thing. I've never met Kevin Dunn a day in my life. I don't even remember what he sounds like from Tough Enough. I'll have to go back and watch it on the network. But I just think of Goofy. I think of Goofy the character from, what the fuck was Goofy? Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse and Goofy and all those guys. I think of Goofy for some reason. I think of Kevin Dunn, I think of Goofy. So that's their logic behind that. You know, they've got Hulk Hogan inducting Randy Savage. Now, whether Hogan is telling the truth or not, that they made up before Randy died, who the hell knows? It's Hulk Hogan. I remember Hogan did some interview after WrestleMania last year and was talking about the Warrior, and Warrior's wife, Dana, got wind of it. And I don't remember what Hogan said, but she got real pissed at him and said, I wish you would stop. Everybody in WWE called or sent a card except you. My daughters asked me, oh, how come he didn't call or send anything? And her response was, well, because there's no camera in our mailbox. That was a sick burn. I still remember that. But look, they picked him because it's more marketable that way. It's all about marketing. That's all the Hall of Fame is. And so they pick Hogan because it's more marketable that way. The Mega Powers, right? Hulk Hogan and the Macho Man. Which, in fairness, they were attached at the hip virtually their entire career. Not just in WWE, but in WCW as well. You know, I'm sure Lanny Poffo will accept on his brother's behalf. I say, why can't Lanny Poffo induct and accept? They do that at some of the award ceremonies. You'll have somebody like the presenter on stage, and then the person wins, and they're not there to accept the award. So the person just stays there, and he says, well, so-and-so's not here to accept the award, so, you know, I'll accept for him. Lanny Poffo, you know, he's a very articulate guy. He's got the poems and everything else, and I'm sure he's got a poem prepared for that Hall of Fame speech that will make people cry. I'm sure. I'm sure of it. I'd be okay with that. Why not just have Lanny induct him and accept? But they wanted Hogan, so they got Hogan. They do what they want to do. Everyone else be damned. we're going to do whatever the hell we want to do, whether you like it or not. That's the mentality here. So I'm happy for the guys that get in. I've been to a few Hall of Fame ceremonies myself. It's a really nice occasion, except for the fans that act like idiots and they heckle. One of the most embarrassing things I've ever seen was the reaction to Trish Stratus' speech a few years ago when she mentioned that she was married and I think having a kid or whatever. And they just, I mean, the fans in the building that night were just complete dickheads. So there are some moments, unfortunately, like that. That's what happens when you have the Hall of Fame not like in a banquet hall and you have it open to the public in a giant arena. You're gonna have stuff like that, unfortunately. But generally speaking, it's a very nice occasion. I'm sure if I ever go to another WrestleMania, I'll want to go to the Hall of Fame too. But that's really all it is. It's a nice little thing for the fans and for the inductees and their families on that night. It is a nice occasion. And that's all it has to be. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But let's not make it out to be more than it actually is, at least not until they institute a real voting process. Now, speaking of Hogan, while we're on the subject, I listened to his interview on Chris Jericho's podcast. He claims, here are some of the claims that he made. He claims that he had no problem jobbing for the Ultimate Warrior at WrestleMania 6 because he knew it would make himself, as in Hogan, a bigger babyface, a more sympathetic babyface. Yet 5 minutes later in the same interview when he's talking about turning heel in WCW, he's telling Jericho that he wanted to turn heel in WWE way back after the Warrior match and had the whole Hollywood Hogan idea even then. And I'm like, which is it? You know, he said, I wanted to turn heel on Raw the next night. That was even better. Monday Night Raw wasn't even on the air back then in 1990. But it's like, which is it? You either wanted to turn heel or you wanted to be the sympathetic babyface. I don't get it. So his new claim, here's another one. His new claim, I've never heard this one before. Maybe it's in his book. I didn't read the book. Maybe, if you use our Audible URL, you can get Hogan's book and he'll actually read it to you. Maybe he talks about it in the book. But he claimed that the WrestleMania 3 match with Andre, going into that match, he did not know what the finish was supposed to be. He didn't know if he was winning or losing. He says Vince McMahon and Andre intentionally did not tell him. I call complete bullshit on that. He also said David Letterman once hit on his pregnant wife, and that's why Letterman never invited him on the show, even though Hogan actually did do David Letterman's show at least once. And this may have been the part that I had the biggest belly laugh over. This may have been the biggest whopper to me of the whole thing. Now, it's true that Roddy Piper would not job to Hulk Hogan. And somehow he got away with it. Piper put his foot down. I am not doing the job to this guy. I don't remember Roddy Piper, now that I think about it, ever doing the job, cleanly by pin or anything to anybody. I mean, think back to his WWF run. Did Roddy Piper ever really lose to somebody? Did he ever get pinned? I don't remember it. I mean, he had all the matches with Hogan, some of which ended on a DQ. WrestleMania 1, you know, was Orndorff who took the fall in that match. Even the boxing match with Mr. T was like a disqualification at WrestleMania 2. WrestleMania 3, he beat Adrian Adonis. Then he left to go make movies, came back. He had a feud with Rick Rude, but it never really manifested into a TV match. They had matches at house shows and stuff. So it's possible Piper lost there. But then he won the Intercontinental title, which was brief, and then he lost to Bret Hart. That's what made the Bret Hart thing such a special thing. Piper never lost. And the fact that he put Bret Hart over at WrestleMania 8, that was a big deal. Would Hulk Hogan have done the same thing? Apparently not, because Hogan had the chance to the following year. In 1993, he could have been the one to do the job to Bret Hart and put him over, and he chose not to. He's too small. I'll lose to the fat guy, and I'll go home. But to go back to this tale here, while it is true that Piper would not do jobs, Hogan said that, man, if only Piper had jobbed to me just once, I would have jobbed to Piper 4 or 5 times. He said, we could have traded the title back and forth so many times and made millions of dollars. He says he wanted to job more often, but Vince McMahon would not let him. That's what Hulk Hogan said. And by the way, I don't doubt that Vince McMahon did not want to job Hulk Hogan out. I mean, Hulk Hogan was the golden goose. You're not going to want to job him out all the time. But again, this is what Hogan said. I would have gladly jobbed for Roddy Piper. I would have gladly jobbed for anybody because that's best for business. See, the problem with Hogan is that he's always in work mode. Always. From the moment he wakes up in the morning to the moment he goes to bed at night, he is always Hulk Hogan. We never really get to see Terry Bollea. So even if he's telling the truth sometimes, 25% of the time, you can never believe him. For every one thing that Hogan says that might actually be true, there's three or four other things that are complete bullshit. But it does make for these interviews to be very entertaining. I would recommend that everybody go listen to Hulk Hogan on Talk is Jericho, because if nothing else, it's great entertainment. High Society, Thurman Taylor, one of our PayPal donators from Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm sitting here watching this Dean Ambrose skit with the psychologist, and I have to say he reminds me so much of Brian Pillman. Do you think WWE will ever let him go out and cut his own original unorthodox promos? This leads into a bigger question, a matter of WWE letting the handcuffs off talent. What do you think it will take for them to let their top stars and mid-card talent go out and wing it? I think when Ambrose was on Jericho's podcast, he told Jericho they don't script his stuff. They usually give him bullet points. I think that's what he said. Ambrose is one of those guys, when he does a promo, he doesn't feel phony when he's out there, you know, which is good. He doesn't. You'll never see a Dean Ambrose promo, for example, and go, man, that was so wooden. What wooden delivery that this guy had. It sounded so fake. No, he has a way of taking bullshit, I guess, and turning it into something. What's the expression? Chicken shit and turning it into chicken salad. Usually it's the other way around. He's got a knack for that, which is good. But you mentioned Brian Pillman. If Brian Pillman were coming up right now in WWE, he wouldn't be allowed to be Brian Pillman. Brian Pillman, as you knew him and as I knew him, would not exist in today's WWE. That's the sad part. He would be just another guy. And you could say that, by the way, about a lot of legends from the past. You could say that about Ric Flair with his white hair. He always looked like an old man. Dusty Rhodes and his physical shape, okay, as great as Dusty Rhodes was. You think for a second if any of those guys came up right now and came through the developmental system, they would get over the way they did back in the day? They would even be given a chance to get over? I mean, yeah, they got a guy like a Bull Dempsey now. How many Bull Dempseys are there? I can't think of very many. For years and years and years, they were churning out guys. I mean, remember Ted DiBiase back in the day, and they told Dolph Ziggler at one point, or maybe it was Dolph Ziggler who made the decision to cut his hair and to dye it brown. I don't think that was his idea. There was a period of time where everybody had to look the same. Everybody had to look like Randy Orton. And it's like, that's fucking boring. I don't want to see five Randy Ortons. I'd rather see one Randy Orton and one Dolph Ziggler and one Dusty Rhodes and one Ric Flair. What's so bad about that? We're King Kong Bundy, for fuck's sake. I was a Bundaholic back in the day. I'd love to have a guy like King Kong Bundy now. Just one. I don't need an army of them. Great Khali. Okay, Great Khali cannot work for shit. His matches sucked. But if the Great Khali didn't have his physical issues, but he was a big, tall guy, but he could actually work a decent match, I'd say he's a worthwhile guy to keep around. Because there aren't very many people who look like the Great Khali. So that's what's so fucking sad about it. Like Brian Pillman today, oh, he'd probably be too small, or his voice is too raspy. We can't put him on TV. People don't want to hear that. That's like being Swiss. Let's make Brian Pillman a tag team with Cesaro. Actually, that'd be a fucking amazing tag team, Brian Pillman and Cesaro. But anyway, that's the sad part about all of this. So you ask, what's it going to take? What's it going to take for WWE to let these guys go out there without the handcuffs and wing it? I'd like to say that it would take Vince McMahon being out of power, but when he's gone, I don't think that stuff is ever going to change much under Triple H and Stephanie. I really don't. It's not like they're going to say, oh, the old man's gone, now go out there and just say whatever you want to say. That's not going to happen. It would take a total change in attitude and the way they conduct their business. I don't know what the answer is, but it's not as simple as Vince McMahon should step down. Vince McMahon could step down tomorrow. I don't really think that means that kind of stuff is going to change. Because you have to understand, Triple H and Stephanie, maybe they would be in power, but there's a lot of non-wrestling people that now work for WWE in high-up positions who don't know the first fucking thing about the wrestling business, you know, 20 years ago. To them, wrestling is, here's a script, memorize your script and go out there. That's how it is. So I really think it would take a complete change in leadership, a complete overhaul of their formulas that they cling to so much, to really make a change like that in WWE. To what you're saying go out there and wing it. Now, they could do tomorrow what you suggested as far as just taking the handcuffs off and saying, here's some bullet points, like apparently they're doing with Ambrose. Go out there and cut a promo. And it's not even about cutting, just about cutting promos. It's about having the creative freedom to sprinkle a few things in here and there and ad lib. And, you know, that's how Austin 316 came about. He says he didn't give that a second thought. He went out there, he cut a promo. He knew that it was Jake Roberts and there were religious overtones, and it just came out of him. Austin 316. You know how much fucking money that company has made off Austin 316? And it was just an ad lib. And people wonder, how come we haven't found the next Steve Austin? How come the next boom period hasn't come yet? Do you really need to ask that question? The answer is right in front of your face. John D'Angelo from Michigan. I was watching an old Raw clip from the early 2000s when Vince McMahon tried to cancel an upcoming six-man Hell in a Cell match only to get destroyed by Austin, Rock, and Undertaker in succession. With the return of the Authority, it seems like it's way overdue for Triple H and Stephanie to get their comeuppance once and for all. Yes, both of them have taken bumps, but neither one has been really knocked around the way that Vince, Shane, and even Eric Bischoff was in WCW. Should they get a really good storyline beating, and if so, how would you like to see it play out? They need to get their comeuppance at WrestleMania, I think, and just be done with this storyline. If this keeps going by the summer, it's going to be 2 years. 2 years of this best-for-business nonsense, and enough's enough. It could be as simple as Sting beating Triple H at WrestleMania to rid the company of the Authority. But you know what? I'd like to see Stephanie be embarrassed by the other divas, given how she beat Brie Bella at SummerSlam without any sort of redemption. And she's had a bunch of promos with AJ Lee where she talked down, like literally looked down and talked down to AJ Lee. And yeah, to her credit, AJ didn't like back off like a scared little schoolgirl, but I almost felt like, why are you doing that? You're making AJ, who at the time is your top diva, may still be their top diva, look like a joke. And there was no payoff, there was no match. I think a match at WrestleMania this year between AJ Lee and Stephanie McMahon could be a great attraction. Plus, I think the promos between them would be killer, because the two of them are two of the best promos in the entire company. AJ Lee, I think, is a very good promo, and Stephanie McMahon may be the best promo in the entire company. And some people may laugh at that, but she's freaking great at being the heel, you know, bitchy owner that you just, ugh, I want to see something bad happen to this woman. Somebody please stand up to her. I think AJ's the one. I think AJ and Stephanie is maybe a match that you could even feature. That's like a feature match at WrestleMania. That's just not another Divas match. That is a feature match at WrestleMania if they do it. But you'd probably have the same people who don't want to see Brock Lesnar and Daniel Bryan because, oh, I can't get over the size difference between them. Those same people would say the same thing about Stephanie and AJ, not seeing the bigger picture here, of course, which is that money would make them a lot of fucking money. Russell in the UK just wanted to note, you said last week it was easier for TNA to hype up a crowd of 500 fans than it would be for WWE to do the same for, say, 6,000. In the UK, TNA does shows in London where there must be at least 5,000 people, and they do the exact same thing that they do in the States, giving away backstage passes and hyping up the crowd, even if it's a house show. So really, there's no excuse for WWE not to put the same effort in, at least for TV tapings, although, how do you motivate a crowd watching 3 hours of Raw every single week? Please. By hour three, the answer is you don't. That's the answer. Especially with these shows lately. I will say, there is an argument to be made that sort of manufacturing of crowd noise that TNA does, which is what it is. I mean, I was there. I saw it. Okay, they get on the mic. We're going to come back from break in 5 seconds. I need you guys to be loud. I mean, they're manipulating the crowd. There is an argument to be made that that kind of manipulation of crowd noise is actually counterproductive if you base who to push and who not to push on genuine crowd reaction, which is how pro wrestling is. I mean, pro wrestling is unlike any other industry in that, yes, the promoter can say, we don't give a shit what the people want, we're going to do this. But in theory, you push people based on whether or not people pay to see them, tune into their segments, and how they react to them at the buildings. And actually, if that were true, Dolph Ziggler and Daniel Bryan would be the two most pushed stars in the company right now. So maybe that's less true these days in WWE, you know, that they actually listen to the fans. But the point is, if you tell them beforehand that the loudest fans go backstage or win a prize, you're muddying the waters. You know, and maybe that's why they don't do it. I don't know. I don't know why they don't do it. There's no other sport or form of entertainment, really, maybe other than stand-up comedy, maybe, where your success hinges so greatly on crowd reaction. If it was pure sport, then your success lies in your performance, right? On the field, on the court. In MMA, it's about how many fights you win, although how entertaining your fights are does factor into it. It does play a small role, more so in whether or not you get like bonus money and stuff like that. You know, it'd be like holding up applause signs off camera, which some promotions did back in the day. But how are you ever supposed to know who's really connecting with the crowd if you control them like that? So I just throw that out there. Again, I don't know why WWE doesn't do it themselves. That could be why. Trevor from Tallahassee, where do you rank Mick Foley and Triple H's rivalry amongst the top feuds in WWE history? To me, it always seemed like they had good chemistry with each other on the microphone and in the ring. They had great chemistry together. I wouldn't say good. They had great chemistry. Their street fight at the Royal Rumble is one of the greatest title matches in Rumble history, I think. They had a memorable street fight on Raw once where Cactus Jack debuted at Madison Square Garden. I enjoyed their cage match at SummerSlam back in 97 that opened the show. Those guys, they worked very well together. And it was Foley in that Rumble match that I think that elevated Triple H to the main event. You know, it elevated Triple H to true main event status for me. I can't speak for everybody else, but that match is what put Triple H over the top for me as a guy that I could really buy into in pay-per-view main events. I still feel like he was missing something before that. And then Foley put him over again the month after in that Hell in a Cell match. Foley really helped give Triple H that harder edge that he was lacking. And I never felt Triple H ever really gave Foley the credit he deserved for the role that he played in his career. I never understood that. He says so. You know, now he says so. Now he gives him credit, I think, on his new DVD. But for years, he never did. And he would actually take little pot shots at him here and there. It always seemed like he had a problem with Mick that I can never really understand. I never understood why. If he resented him for some reason, like he resented this idea that Mick Foley, the guy that Ric Flair called a glorified stuntman, was somehow responsible or, you know, instrumental in him getting over as a main eventer. It's almost like he resented that notion. That's how it always felt to me, anyway. And I know Foley's son, Dewey, obviously felt that his dad helped make Triple H a main eventer. He went on that Facebook tirade last year, if you remember, and said that without my dad, Triple H is nothing more than a mid-carder. Now, I don't know that I would go that far, but his dad definitely helped him out a lot. I think those two had great chemistry together. Brian from Orlando, I was watching random videos on YouTube and came across Randy Savage's debut against Aldo Moreno in 1985. As I was watching the match, I noticed many legendary managers coming out, like Mr. Fuji, Bobby Heenan, and Jimmy Hart. It was said on commentary that they were out to scout the Macho Man. Did WWE often do this with new talent? Also, what year did WWE stop putting focus on the managers altogether? And can you see the return of, say, five or more managers competing for a superstar service in today's WWE? They did it a couple of times, but not often. Not really. You know, it was a way to get Savage over as something special. In fact, Savage may have been the first person they ever did that with. They had all of the managers courting him for like weeks, and then he ended up going with Elizabeth instead. They did something very similar with Bam Bam Bigelow when he came over to WWE in, I want to say, 87. When he came in each week, somebody new would court him, like Slick. You know, different managers would try to court his services, and they'd be eliminated from the running. They'd put a big X over their head. They'd have like an event center update. No, this week Slick tried to recruit Bam Bam Bigelow, and it didn't work. And they'd put an X over his face and say, next week, you know, who's going to try to recruit Bam Bam? And then in the end, he ended up going with Oliver Humperdinck as his manager. I don't know where that came from. So it made the guy feel special, you know, that he had all these different managers competing for him. As far as what year they stopped putting the focus on managers, I don't think you can really pinpoint a specific year. They really started phasing them down after the Attitude Era, I think. Paul Bearer was still around then. You had China, some of the other women, Sable. I'd probably say early 2000s is when it really happened. They had Heyman. Maybe they had one or two other people I'm not remembering, but the idea of the wrestling manager in the traditional sense was kind of dead. It was kind of a dead concept by that point. And no, I don't think we'll ever see a return to those days where you had five different managers, you know, vying for one guy. I think those days are long gone. Steve, from Stockton, California, who do you think should have made up WCW's five-man team at the Invasion pay-per-view? Don't you love these Invasion questions that I get every now and then? And I know a lot of you have heard this before. I'll put a little bit of a different spin on it this time. You know my thoughts on the Invasion and what a botch that whole thing was. Here's how I would have done it. Just, again, I got the question from Steve. I gave it a little bit of thought. I kind of jotted down some names. I would say, you know, Vince McMahon leads Team WWF of Steve Austin, newly turned babyface Steve Austin, for good, not done as a swerve, because the Austin heel turn was a failure. It killed business for them. So I would have turned him and I would have kept him at that point as a babyface. As the leader, you have Undertaker, you have Kane, you have Chris Jericho, and you have Kurt Angle. The Rock at this point was, he was still gone, or he was only first like coming back. I think he came back a few weeks later. He was off making a movie, so we put Rock on the side. Then you have Ric Flair, leading Team WCW of Bill Goldberg, Sting, DDP, Booker T, and Scott Steiner. Eric Bischoff comes out near the finish of the big match. Maybe he attacks McMahon, because McMahon is in the corner of Team WWF, right? So Bischoff comes from out of nowhere. He attacks McMahon, lays him out. Nobody knows why he's out there. All of a sudden, out of the crowd comes the NWO, Hulk Hogan, and Scott Hall, and Kevin Nash with weapons, and they attack the WWF guys, which leads to either Scott Steiner or Booker T. Maybe Booker T would be a better choice, getting the pin to kind of get that rub. Maybe Steiner. Steiner might work better, actually, because he was a heel at that time. And I would do it where the WCW guys, you know, after the match is over, like the next night and everything, they didn't know what was going to happen. This was all a shock to them as well. So that guy, the baby faces like Goldberg and Sting, maybe even Flair, can be just appalled by the NWO interfering in this match, and that gives them a starting point for their own TV show. Because if the idea was to branch WCW off as its own show and keep the rosters apart, which was the plan, you've got to have heels and you've got to have baby faces. You can't just have all the WCW guys as heels, right? That doesn't make any sense unless you're just going to make them a faction, which is what they did anyway with the Alliance. If you want WCW to exist on its own as a separate brand and a TV show, you've got to have baby faces, you've got to have heels. So it's important to have the baby faces say, wait a minute, we didn't sign up for this. We didn't know the NWO was going to come out. This is bullshit. We hate those guys just as much as you do. I mean, you don't want all of WCW to come out of that pay-per-view as the evil bad guys. That's not a good role for Sting and Goldberg. So now you've got WCW as its own separate brand. You've got some big names on top. But the difference is, what killed WCW was that those guys stayed on top all the time. They never left. They were always there, right? Now the key would be to elevate some newer guys, some younger guys as well. But you can't not have those big names. I'm not the kind of person, oh, they should just push Chris Benoit and Billy Kidman and Rey Mysterio and Juventud. You've got to have big names. You have to. That's why, you know, Lucha Underground is looking to bring in big names, and they just brought in one at their tapings, okay? You ask yourself, why do they need guys like that? Because they're big names that people recognize, and you need names like that. I'm sure Rey Mysterio probably at some point is going to end up there as well. Whether he can work a match or not, I think that would be an excellent signing for Lucha Underground, because Rey Mysterio is a name. He's got a lot of fans out there, and Lucha Underground is getting 34,000 viewers on El Rey. Now, it may not matter. If people don't have El Rey, they can't watch. But the bigger names you get, in theory, the better chance you'll have of boosting the brand. Now, that never really happened with TNA. That's a bad example to give. But TNA also didn't know what the fuck they were doing half the time. So, you know, a lot of that was their own doing. But the audience wants to see stars. Just use them in a more effective way. That's all you have to do. I think something like that would really get people talking. And months down the road, maybe at WrestleMania 18, when you're really ready for that big supercard of WWF guys against WCW guys, and the WCW brand has been established now for a year, 9 months, whatever it is, as its own standalone show with its own storylines. Interest, I think, at that point in a supercard would be just through the roof. And you could have that big Austin versus Hogan match. You can have The Rock versus Hogan maybe instead and do Austin versus Goldberg. You could do Undertaker versus Sting when both were more closer to their prime. You know, or whatever. Or look, they could just not do WCW altogether as a separate brand and just use the idea that I outlined, as a starting point for a WWF versus WCW war on WWF television. However they want to handle it. Even if they couldn't get all of those guys at once, they couldn't buy out all of their contracts. Maybe some guys didn't want to. Look, if it was me, it would have been hard to be like, I know the WWF wants me, but you know what? I can sit on my couch and play with my kid and make $1.5 million on the rest of my contract. That's a hard thing to say no to. I mean, I have a lot of respect for Booker T and DDP who turned down, you know, that chance to just sit at home and make big money, and they made lesser deals because they wanted so badly to become part of WWE. Like, I have a lot of respect for those guys for that. I don't know if I could have done the same thing. I really don't. I could have been like a Kevin Nash and said, fuck you, I'm sitting home making my money. But the key is that eventually all of these guys ended up making the deal anyway. They all ended up coming in. Goldberg, Hall, Nash, Steiner, all of them. Bischoff. So if somehow they could have gotten some of those guys 6 months earlier, a year earlier than they did, you only needed a handful of those guys to make something like that work. If you got all of them, shit, even better. And you would have made that money, whatever money you paid them to buy them out of their contract, believe me, you would have made that money back 10 times over. The Marietta Mahler, Alexandru, writes in, I've got two questions. First, how can WWE make the Intercontinental title relevant again, since they've completely watered it down over the past few years? Also, would you take Jeff Jarrett over Randy Orton or vice versa? I'd personally take Jarrett, as while it's debatable whether or not he's a true main event guy, he's still solid in the ring and, unlike Orton, has mic skills. Also, to me, Jarrett drew more than Orton, since he sold a ton of shirts in WCW. What? Orton is good, but he just comes across as a robot. My head just hurts reading that. Alex, I love you, buddy, but you're out of your mind picking Jeff Jarrett over Randy Orton. Now, credit where credit is due. Jeff Jarrett had success just about everywhere he went. He won the Intercontinental title in WWE, tag team champion there, multiple runs, U.S. champion, WCW champion in that promotion, although that was in the dying days. TNA was his promotion, but he had a great series of matches with Kurt Angle. He's got a great mind for the business, okay? There's a lot that Jeff Jarrett can offer and can bring to the table. But if I'm starting a wrestling company, and I have to choose as a performer, Jeff Jarrett or Randy Orton right now, even if Jarrett was 10 years younger than he is right now, I go with Randy Orton all day, all night. Hands down. Orton's been pampered since day one, true. But he's a great performer. He'd be a top star wherever he goes. Even if he wasn't getting pampered and somewhere else and he went to TNA. Maybe that's a bad example. But if he went anywhere else, he would be a top star wherever he goes. Maybe not the top guy. In some places he would be. But even in the places where he wasn't the top guy, like the John Cena of the promotion, he'd be right next to that person. And I guarantee you Randy Orton has made a small fortune off of his t-shirts that dwarfs whatever Jeff Jarrett shirt sold in WCW. I don't know where you got that stat that Jeff Jarrett sold or made millions of dollars off all of his t-shirts in WCW. I don't know if you're just pulling that out of thin air or what. I can guarantee you, I don't even need to see the figures, I can guarantee you that Randy Orton has made a small fortune far greater than anything Jeff Jarrett made on his shirts in WCW. And to go back to your first question about what to do with the Intercontinental title, you know, I'm not a huge fan of just taking a guy like John Cena and saying, well, he's a top guy, so let's just put the Intercontinental title on him and it'll mean more. Because I'm not sure that it would. It all depends on the booking. I would be okay with taking a guy maybe at a level below Cena. Even a guy like an Orton, who I'm sure has no interest in being anywhere near the Intercontinental title. But an Orton, Brian, maybe, you know, somebody on that level, and putting the Intercontinental title on them. Or let's use the U.S. title as an example, because Rusev has it, right? Eventually, Rusev is going to get beat. Let's say Rusev gets beat by a guy who's kind of high up on the totem pole. I'm just throwing Dean Ambrose out there. I don't expect it to be him, but let's just say it's Dean Ambrose. Now Dean Ambrose is the U.S. champion, which he was once before, by the way, and he never defended it. But let's say they actually take it more seriously this time. And now he's defending the U.S. title against Bray Wyatt, and he's defending the U.S. title against Seth Rollins, and guys that actually have a name. That might be the only way to really, you know, elevate that title up to a level where people don't look at it as a joke, and they're like, wow, it's an Intercontinental title match. This is a big deal. Maybe joke is too strong of a word, okay? I'm not saying everybody looks at the Intercontinental title and says, ha-ha, like, what a joke. But when was the last time there was an Intercontinental title match that really felt epic? Like, really felt, this is a big, like, an important match. This match has repercussions. These are two guys that are both going to be world champion one day, and they're fighting right now to be the Intercontinental champion. It's been a long time. As great of a match that Ziggler and Harper had at TLC, there was nothing. I didn't go into that match thinking, what an epic match this is going to be. I said, it's probably going to be a pretty good ladder match, but it had nothing to do with the title. When was the last time you really felt that way about either of those mid-card belts? I bet you $1 million it's been a very long time. So I think that probably is the way to do it. You got to get somebody with credibility who actually wins matches and is kind of a top guy in the company, or somebody that people look at as a main event level guy, and let them feud over the Intercontinental title for a little bit. And you know what? Put the Intercontinental title in the Raw main event spot sometimes. I mean, hell, maybe there's a B-show pay-per-view you can even headline with the Intercontinental title match. You can, you know, run a house show loop and headline the house shows with Intercontinental title main events. If you've got big enough stars in there, the people are not buying a house show ticket to see a championship. They're buying it to see stars. But if they see two stars and the title happens to be on the line, then by default, that title in theory is going to mean more, no? So, I mean, there's little things like that I think that you can do. And, of course, they never will. Let's do one last question here. These are great questions. Cody from South Carolina. My question is in regards to Roddy Piper. I have always thought that if Piper was not in WCW during the Attitude Era, that some Piper's Pit segments with the likes of Steve Austin and Vince McMahon, DX, and The Nation would have made for amazing television. Do you think this kind of thing could have worked during the Attitude Era, or would it have been seen as something too old school? Here's what I think. I don't think that would have worked. Piper was still very good on the mic, but he was the old guy at that point. And it flew in the face of everything that Attitude Era was supposed to represent. You know, in the Attitude Era, it wasn't about bringing in the old guys. It was a youth movement with some veteran stars mixed in. I know Austin and Undertaker and Mick Foley were not exactly young at that point. But they also, you know, in some cases, never really had a fair shot. And in WWE, they had that shot to really get over. And in other cases, some of the guys actually were very young. Believe it or not, these guys that you see now that they trot out there on Raw Reunion, once upon a time, they actually were somewhat youthful. And that's really what the Attitude Era was all about. And if you remember, some of the more whacked out promos that Roddy Piper was cutting on Nitro at that time, some of that stuff was really bad. I mean, for every really great Piper promo, there were like three terrible ones. And the guy was just whacked out of his mind. You thought this guy is legitimately out of his gourd. Like, what he's saying doesn't make any sense. And he's, like, using old-school references that flew over people's heads. I've gone back and watched some of those Nitro segments, and it's just, some of it is really bad television. Just not good. And I'll tell you what would have been amazing. Roddy Piper from 1982 to 1986, that Roddy Piper in the Attitude Era, that would have been unbelievable. Talk about a guy that was ahead of his time. He would have fit in very nicely with those guys. In that way, I think Piper would have been a huge success in the Attitude Era, just not the version of Piper I think that you're talking about. And again, Piper from 82 to 86, whatever he may have been on, even then, he wasn't like the biggest guy. And in the Attitude Era, a lot of it was still about bodies and being big and muscular and all that kind of stuff. But I think Piper in that era, in his prime in the 80s, was so good on the microphone. Not even as a wrestler, just like as a shit-stirring heel. He would have gotten over as one of the biggest stars of the entire Attitude Era. You know, the stuff he could have gotten away with in the late 90s, had it been that younger version of Piper being allowed to get away with some of that stuff on TV, that would have been must-see TV. And you know, it's kind of sad, and I've actually said the same thing to people who have asked me about Brian Pillman. You know, had he not died, what would have happened? From what I understand, Pillman wanted to go back to WCW, which I don't know why, but you know, before he died, he was either trying to or very shortly hoping to make the jump to WCW. And had Pillman been alive when the Montreal Screwjob happened, you know, Owen Hart wanted to bail. Vince wouldn't let him. Bulldog actually paid Vince, I think, I remember reading it was like $125,000 that Bulldog paid Vince McMahon just to get out of his contract. That's how badly he wanted to get out of there. I think had the Montreal Screwjob happened and Pillman as close as he was as part of the Hart Foundation, I think he probably would have been like, fuck this, I'm out of here too. And he would have used that as an excuse to go back to WCW. But had that not happened, and had Pillman stayed, and not, this is all what if Pillman stays, if Pillman isn't hurt from the car accident, and that crazy loose cannon Brian Pillman is around in 98 when Austin wins the title, I think Austin's first feud is not with Dude Love. I think Austin's first feud is with Brian Pillman. And I think they have some pretty fucking great brawls and just bloody shit and maybe trade the title back a couple of times. I don't think it really affects Austin's run, but I think that's Austin's first feud right there. And I think Pillman gets a brief run with the belt. This week's sad tweet is actually a series of tweets earlier in the week that went back and forth between two former WWE divas, Sunny, Tammy Sitch, and Ashley Massaro. Remember her? So it started with Sunny. I guess Sunny and Ashley have had issues before that I was unaware of because I don't give a shit. So this kind of dredged up some old issues between the two of them. Sunny, if you don't know, has been essentially selling herself on Skype. And for a fee, you can you can watch Sunny. I guess she kind of touches herself and is masturbating. You know what? I almost threw up in my mouth. I don't even want to think about it. So Sunny sends a tweet out. Says, Skyping tonight, ask about my new project, blah, blah, blah. FYI, for those of you emailing me asking to hook up, I'm not an escort. Tweet to Ashley Massaro. I heard she has a history in that field. And Ashley heard about this, and so she responded and said, I find it hilarious that Sunny is talking trash about me again. I received this photo from a fan a while ago and took the high road and never posted it. And she posted a nude photo of Sunny pleasuring herself on Skype. There is not enough bleach in the world that I could use to erase this image from my mind. And then Ashley posts, she says, I'm pretty sure that about sums up who's the one selling themselves. I work, I love my fans, my job. She sells herself to the fans. A fan sent this to me a few months ago. I didn't post it because Sunny had not crossed me lately, but she pushed me, talking shit, so here it is. I honestly thought that Sunny and I had squashed the drama. I don't know why she decided to trash talk me again, but hope you're happy now, girl. Well, I hope somebody's happy, because I sure as hell am not, after looking at that. If you have suggestions for Sad Tweet, you can always tweet them to me, at Solomonster. Also, I ask that you stop whatever you're doing right now and vote for the Solomonster Sounds Off in the 2015 Wrestling Radio Awards. We have made the final cut. We are among the final six in the running for Show of the Year. So if you go to WrestlingRadioAwards.com, you'll find the ballot. I believe we're on line two. You'll see where it says Show of the Year. We are one of six. You can choose the sound off and cast your vote only once a day. Don't abuse it. Don't vote more than once each day, because if you do, they'll know, and then all of your votes are disqualified. So vote once a day, every day, for the foreseeable future. I have no idea when the cutoff is, other than they are announcing the winner on January 30th. So please vote every day between now and then. You can vote for the sound off for Show of the Year. And let your friends know, let them vote as well, and show your support for the podcast. You can, again, follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. We have a fan page that you can like, and when you do, if you apply for membership in our private discussion group, you will gain entry there. I got my boy, Zach House of Pain Holker, who for the second year in a row is hosting our, the second annual Sound Off Facebook group Royal Rumble Pool. And actually, he had such an overwhelming response. There's a whole series of pools. We had, I think the number was like 150 people participated last year. And at last count, it was well more than double. It was like 360 people or something like that that are in the pool. So the thread is in there somewhere. It's not sticky at the top anymore. There may still be time to get in on that. It's always a lot of fun. I'm in the pool. Most people get into it. And all the rules on how it works are up there. I'm sure Zach will post about it again. So a lot of fun stuff going on in that group. So just like the fan page. And again, you can apply for entry to the group and I will approve you. It is invitation only. We have a YouTube channel as well. YouTube.com/TheSolomonster. Where we have bonus videos that go up every now and then. I am planning on doing a Royal Rumble wrap-up the day after the show. I have some time, so that'll be a Sound Off Extra exclusive to YouTube. I haven't decided yet if I'm going to push that out to the feed. I usually don't. It's exclusive content to the YouTube channel. So if it does go up, you will need to subscribe to the channel to find out when it goes up. So please head on over there, hit the subscribe button, and you can enjoy all of your bonus Sound Off audio content to your heart's content. We will be back here with a brand new show next weekend. That'll be the Royal Rumble Prediction Show, episode 365. I feel like I'm doing audio 365 days out of the year. I'm going to be on Wrestling Soup this Tuesday, January 20th, 8 p.m. Eastern. Head over to WrestlingSoup.com. I'll be on with Missionary and Joey Numbers. That should be a lot of fun. We'll be taking live calls. I'll be on Heartbeat Radio with Bruce Hart Thursday night at 9 o'clock. Again, all of these shows will be archived after the fact. If you miss them, I'll make sure I put links up on Twitter and Facebook. Back for a new podcast next weekend, the Royal Rumble Extra the following Monday. So there's a lot of good stuff coming up. You can show your support for the podcast, all of this work. Again, it's all free to you. You can listen to it and not have to really do anything if you don't want to, but your support is greatly appreciated. This is a free show after all. You can make a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. And plus, when you support the show, it just tells me that you really do like what you hear. It's kind of a validation for all the work that goes into it. I would almost think you didn't care if you didn't show your support in some way. So whether that's in a PayPal donation, whether that's just using our Audible link and signing up for a trial, audibletrial.com/Solomonster, or buy a shirt. We got a brand new shirt, actually two brand new shirts up in the store. Same design, two different color shirts. Head over to prowrestlingtees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off for that. Vote for us on WrestlingRadioAwards.com, and that's it. We're out of here. We're all out of time, 2.5 hours in. So until next weekend, be well, stay safe. I guess I'll see you guys on the soup Tuesday night, back for a new show next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster Sounds Off.
They give us the dreaded fuck finish. Lame, lame, lame. You want to do the finish where the guy gets DQ'd for kicking ass? How about not doing it with your Intercontinental Champion? How about that? Some of these matches will go 10, 12, 15 minutes only to get a fuck finish or no finish at all in the end. If WWE insists on fucking the fans over so many times, the least they can do is buy us dinner first.
Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.